AM on March the 11th, 2020. I'll begin to our roll call, noting that all physician board members are present. Drs. Campbell, Yolano, and Foreman, our public member, Mr. John Rhodes, our executive director, Ms. Heather Brodus, and assistant attorney general, Seamus Monahan, Esquire. Does anyone have any conflicts of interest to declare at this meeting? I'm going to go ahead and move on to number five, our items for board review, discussion of possible action. This is under heading A for investigation files. Is Dr. Cohn on the phone? And
I am.
Complaint. Dr. Cohn?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And do we have the complainant in this case? This is for 19-24-C, Dr. Melissa Galley. This is a carryover from previous meeting. We were missing some items and asked Dr. Cohn to review x-rays, and he is going to go ahead and give us a report on his findings. And do we also have Dr. Galley on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. All righty. So we will then begin with Dr. Cohn, please. And also note that Mr. Scott King is present, Dr. Galley's attorney.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm David Willing. I'm the complainant.
Sir, we ask that you refer to yourself by your initials only. So we will hear first from Dr. Cohn, then we'll give
you.
I know you spoke at the previous meeting, and when Dr. Cohn is done, you will be allowed to just kind of give us a short 5-minute update or summary, and then after that, we hear from Dr. Galley and her attorney. So, Dr. Cohn, please.
And just from a technical point, you want me to keep it on mute until then, is that correct?
Please, that prevents the background noise.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Cohn.
Okay, this is so for case 1924-C with Dr. Melissa Galley, it's been a little bit, but it was back on in November. I did review the entire, you know, my presentation of the investigation at the time. Do you need me to review that with you, or are you comfortable?
It would be for Dr. Yolano.
Yeah, Dr. Yolano was not here at that time. Do you want him to give a short summary?
Sure.
Okay, that would be fine. Dr. Cohn, a short summary then?
Sure. So the complainant raised allegations associated with surgery performed by Dr. Galley. Prior to the surgery, he stated he was able to run and wished to get back to running and his full activities. And he's not been able to do so since the surgery. His other issue with it was that he had relocated to Virginia and had been prescribed and I believe received the bone stimulator. And there was no further contact from Dr. Galley's office concerning use of the bone stimulator, and felt that even though he had moved to Virginia, it was the responsibility of Dr. Galley to contact him about the bone stim. As far as the written response from Dr. Galley herself, she reviewed the entire treatment. That's enough, and you could review her review of the case was very good as well from a medical standpoint. Dr. Galley did describe to her, you know, throughout I'd say from the middle forward, a portion of treatment forward, a pattern of noncompliance. As far as the medical records, I'm going to pass that. I believe that you have a copy of my investigation on hand. Within the medical record, and then as an addendum, I did with an addendum for you of additional x-rays that was separated out. My review of the x-rays was essentially the same as those as the readings that were provided by both the radiologist for things such as the MRI studies or from Dr. Galley's own report itself. I do concur with what their readings of the report, the x-rays were. And yes, it did appear as if there may be some gapping and some difficulty with the non-union. Dr. Galley did proceed with some studies such as the CT I believe it was the one in October of 2018, to confirm a positioning of a fixation device, and somewhere, as well as to determine how much the extent of any issues with fixation. I did interview both patients and Dr. Galley. Concerning the patient, he had seen a physician at Atoka, but had to change to Dr. Galley, which is, I believe, CORE, because of insurance issues. He did not do it for any other reasons, and he had done his conservative care through the prior treating physician. Stated he discontinued physical therapy because of financial concerns. He states he does still wear his UCBL, but doesn't find it to be a comfortable device to use. With Dr. Galley, I questioned her concerning reasoning for starting to discuss the AMA discussions that she had throughout the notes, and her feeling was that it became more relevant later and therefore was more prominent within the notes because as the perceived treatment went on, the patient started to become a little more confrontational, and felt that it was necessary to document. She was to bring a consent with her or the attorney today to provide you because I did not see a copy of the consent. My conclusion was that the case was an unsubstantiated case. These cases are difficult. There are times you there are things in this case that you might find to be concerning. The patient did have issues with healing. I don't believe there's a question with that. But there are complications from surgeries, and that's not necessarily malpractice. It's not practicing outside the standard of care. It's something that happens, especially when you're discussing cases in performing cases in the midfoot and the rear foot with surgical fusions. So I felt that after reviewing the case, I felt her care was appropriate. I felt she recognized things. I felt she was aware of the complications that could occur, and she did work them up. I did have, and within my notes at the conclusion, you see, I did have a mention about conservative care, but from her discussions, that seems to be alleviated in that she stated that the care was performed through the previously treating podiatrist and clinic she presented to. The only other concern that I do have, and mentioned, but was that there are multiple high-level office visit codes that were used throughout the medical records, and I felt that they were higher than were necessary for the treatments that are performed. Even though there are times where this patient was dealing with complications and Dr. Galley was evaluating them, I feel some of these codes were generated and they were too high. It's likely that came through her billing office, but I do believe the physicians themselves are responsible to know what some of their billing coding is. I hope that's adequate, brief summary for you.
That sounds good. Thank you. I have some questions, Dr. Cohn. On your report, actually it says a fusion. Was it the first metatarsal cuneiform joint? Isn't it the navicular cuneiform joint that was fused?
I'm going to go back to the apical surgical procedures. What did our posterior talar, non-union, or nostrum, trigonum, medial calcaneal displacement osteotomy, navicular cuneiform joint fusion. I have in my notes navicular cuneiform joint fusion. I did not re-review from the prior time the operative report, so I'm not sure what the operative report says. As far as, I'm just trying to see if I can find my post-op, what my post-op says. Ankle fusion fixation in both areas was intact. Yeah. I'd have to relook at the x-rays, which I did not put up on my computer this morning.
Okay. On my, well, we can, you guys can see on the on the x-rays?
Yes.
So it was the...
yeah, it was the...
It's the navicular cuneiform fusion instead. Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to correct
that. So it was...
Pardon me?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I didn't hear what Keith said.
The x-rays do show that it's the navicular cuneiform joint that was fused, not the met cuneiform.
Midfoot, yes.
Okay, so okay. That just... Can we note that that change in his report, Heather? Thank you. Back to the conservative care issue. Do you feel, Dr. Cohn, if the patient had undergone maybe some strengthening through PT and maybe better orthotic control, that if the patient eventually did have to go into surgery, that they would have had maybe possibly a better result, or
no. I don't think so.
Okay.
He had a pes planus. It was, you do all the therapy to strengthen the posterior tib we want to strengthen out the Achilles tendon. But there's certain times where there's deformities that they're not going to relieve. You can't, unless you reduce them and tighten other areas up, it's just not going to reduce the deformity present, and they're not going to be able to successfully rehab it without the additional surgery.
And my other question preoperatively too here is, this patient was seen by Stephanie Dunn, who is a family nurse practitioner. She saw this patient on, 116 of 18, and then Dr. Galley saw the patient, I think, just a few days later for the initial visit. And at that time, the family nurse practitioner noted that the patient had rheumatoid arthritis and had been on, was on methotrexate, 3 tablets a week. And this is not noted anywhere. I did see, you know, the notations for rheumatoid, and then sometimes there were notations for osteoarthritis. So I was just a little concerned that that had not been better evaluated prior to surgery, just because of the whole underlying issue of what rheumatoid does to bone, what it does to tendons, particularly insertional problems. So I just wanted to know if you had noticed that or if you had any concern.
You can have concerns with it, but that doesn't mean that you don't proceed with surgery if a patient had failed the conservative care of the prior physicians. And if they failed that conservative care and the doctor has made them aware on their consent, which I have not seen, then that there are complications and he's at an increased risk with medical systemic issues, then I think it's still appropriate. We do surgeries on diabetic patients with Charcot feet all the time. So I think there are times that you have to do these surgeries if you're going to attempt to get the patient asymptomatic or at least improved.
And do you feel go ahead, please.
No, I was just saying it was certainly a risk. That's all. But I think that's a contraindication.
Right. And do you feel that, was there any evidence to you that there was any possible unrealistic expectation for activity level for this individual after the surgery and the periods of healing and rehabilitation?
There's a possibility of that. But that's a he said, she said, and I wasn't in the room.
Right.
I really don't know how much she spoke up the procedure, but any type of procedure. We do a bunion, and how am I going to be walking in shoes in 6 weeks sometimes? And they hear 6 weeks, but think it means they can walk in 4 weeks. I don't think the doctor did wrong. I wasn't in the room to hear what she exactly said. It is possible based on some of what DW describes this, his complaint, that he had an unrealistic expectation. This person was not going back to running after the surgery. You're right.
And one more question. On the op report, I'm a little concerned about the lack of detail and documentation about the appearance of the posterior tibial tendon other than being lax, very lax.
I mentioned that in my investigative report. I think that's for you to discuss with Dr. Kelly. That's why it was pointed out within the investigation report itself. It's in brackets with a portion of posterior tibial tendon. Go ahead.
I think some of the other board members have questions for you too, Dr. Cohn. So. Sure.
Yeah, sure. But I did put it in my, because I felt that's the board investigate, you know, something the board may want to direct attention to. It is put in there.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
All righty. Gentlemen. Dr. Foreman?
No, I had a question for Dr. Galley, not for Dr.
Okay,
Cohn.
Do you have a question for Dr. Cohn?
Sure. Dr. Cohn, I want to know your opinion. Do you feel the age, medical condition, and the extent of surgery had something to do with the complications of the healing?
I didn't quite hear you. You said my opinion concerning his age?
Sorry. I had a question. The age,
okay,
the person's medical condition, and the extent of the surgery can complicate the healing process for this patient?
Sure. Doesn't mean that you don't do it, but yes. Age, medical history, all of that makes this a complicated case. And when you can, you know, and it's a tough area to work. So yes,
sure,
it does. This wouldn't be the only patient this age that's having surgery today, that's having something similar to this done, that's older with medical issues. So yes, I agree with you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Cohn. Oh, Mr. Rose, I apologize.
Do you feel the office visit
that anyone could
have been charged?
I'm sorry, Dr. Campbell.
Mr. Rose doesn't have his mic on. Just a second.
On the office visits, yeah, it appears that some of them could have been upcharged. Did you look into that?
I agree. Yes, I think they are upcharged. That's what I meant. That's what I meant within my conclusion. Yes. I concern was observed with their generated charges, multiple high-level visits, and I don't believe they were supported.
Thank you.
Thank you very
You're
much,
welcome.
Dr. Cohn. Are you able to stay on the line for a while if we have other questions that we come back with?
Yes, I have to 9:15.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
All right, now, now our complainant. We can go ahead and ask. We'll give you, like I said, about 5 minutes to give us a summary. I know you spoke to us before previously, so please give us your review.
Good morning.
Is he on there?
Okay. Yes. Good morning. This is GW. Couple notes. First of all, I'm still in the pain that I've described in the complaint. I have seen two board-certified surgeons in this area. One of them was the Virginia Podiatrist of the Year. Both have come to conclusions that there are some major issues with my foot as it stands right now. I've decided of the two, I'm going to, a week from today, I'm having surgery under Dr. Toomey, who is a board-certified surgeon. He's going to take a conservative approach initially, and he's going to remove all the hardware. In approximately 2 to 3 to 4 months after that's removed, he's going to take an MRI to see what kind of damage, if any, has been done. And then he's going to have to reconstruct my foot. The foot points out to the left like about 10 o'clock. There is major nerve damage. I can't walk without limping. I cannot walk up a hill. I cannot walk up the stairs. I have to crab walk all the time. I'm in constant pain. So that's where I'm at. You know, both of these board certified surgeons, so I'm welcome. I'm happy to give you their names. I will sign whatever consents there might be if you are interested in having their opinions. I also have had a CT scan done by Dr. Toomey. I mean, there is damage done from the surgery. And both of the surgeons that I spoke with, that when I mentioned that I was basically being told that... Okay. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No, not yet.
Hello?
No. Are you done with your remarks?
No, someone started to speak, so I stopped to find out if somebody had a question.
No, not yet. That will happen here shortly. Just a second. Gentlemen, do you have questions for the complainant?
I mean,
I have a couple questions, sir. Are you currently being treated for rheumatoid arthritis?
No. I mean, I have arthritis all over my body, but no, I'm not taking currently any medication for arthritis. I'm taking, I don't have a list of the medication right here. I'm sitting in my car talking, you know,
to keep my
battery up.
Are you wearing wearing any kind of a brace or an orthotic?
I have the UCBL brace that I wear all the time, which is, it does some good, but very little, really. It's extremely uncomfortable. It's almost impossible to buy shoes because in order to try it on, you have to rip the shoe apart because the thing's so damn big. But, yeah, I wear that all the time. So that's where that's at. And like I say, a week from today, I'm having surgery with Dr. Toomey, who will be removing the hardware. I've had, I went to a neurologist here, Dr. Gill, who also mentioned, as have the neurologist in Phoenix, that I have pretty significant nerve damage. He's hoping that in removing the hardware, there might be some impact or some reduction of the pain. One of the things stated by Dr. Toomey was that there's a loosening of one of the screws. He mentioned that this CT scan appears to show one of the screws entering into a joint area, which could be the possibility of some of the pain. He also states... that I need revisional flat foot deformity. I don't know what that means. I'm just reading it. There's regarding the patient's concern for nerve damage. I feel the patient likely has a nerve pain from his tibial nerve being in inappropriate position from his flat foot deformity, in addition to the dorsocutaneous nerve from the current position of the screw that is within the third met base cuneiform region. I advise removal of the hardware waiting 3 to 6 months afterwards and then having an MRI for his of his foot to evaluate damage. I'm not sure what that means, but, you know, I thought you should know that what was written.
All right. Thank you very much. I believe no one else has any questions. So now we will move on to hearing from Dr. Galley and her attorney, Scott King. Mr. King, do you want to make a comment?
I'm sorry. I would like to make another comment.
One more, and that's it.
All right. Fine. Thanks. I'm a little bit put off by the description that I was non-compliant. It is true that I did not do as much rehab as was prescribed, but the reality is I was broke and I couldn't work because of the pain of the surgery. In fact, like at this Christmas time, I tried to get a part-time job. I secured a part-time job, but I had to quit after one day on the job because of standing on my feet. I could no longer walk the rest of the day. So, I mean, this is no small issue, and both of the surgeons here do that as a result of what was taking place earlier with the previous surgery. No conservative actions were ever taken up with me. No mention of an orthotic or anything of that nature was ever brought up. It was immediately straight to surgery. Furthermore, regarding the running, yes, she told me I would be able to run again. Now, you know, I questioned that, but I said, are you sure I'm going to be able to run again? In fact, the last thing I asked her before I went under, are you sure I'm going to be able to run again? The response, yes. Now, if there are expectations on my part that were unrealistic, it was not coming from me. It was coming from the doctor. Furthermore, I was never told about any possibility of there being something called impingement. When I originally went to her, you know, I'd been complaining about the pain for quite some time, and I went to her finally, and she did an x-ray. She said, oh, there seems to be an impingement. I went, an impingement? What's that? You never mentioned that. Furthermore, she never mentioned that there was a possibility that infusing a joint together wasn't going to take. So in essence, I've been walking around with two bones rubbing against each other constantly with significant nerve damage and with a bone that didn't heal up. Now, I will point out that the bone stimulator was successful in finally healing up that bone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you, if you would mute your phone back, that would be appreciated. Thank you. All right. So now again, it's for Dr. Galley, who is on the phone, and we have Mr. King, her attorney, is present. So, Dr. King, do you want to make a statement for Mr. King?
I would, after Dr. Galley speaks, please.
Okay. So, Dr. Galley, this is Dr. Campbell. If would you like to respond to the questions and comments you've heard, or that may be an easier way to approach this, or just review through your summary?
I'll try to take a quick brief and not take too much more of the board's time. I appreciate the amount of time you guys have spent on this investigation. So when Mr. Willing came to my office, number one, the medications are provided by patients of what they're currently on. Yes, in his referral, he had stated that he was from Stephanie Dunn. She had listed that she had prescribed methotrexate, but at the when we do our office intake, at that time he stated he was not on that medication. Furthermore, when you're evaluating a rheumatoid patient, within the literature, it's well documented that you actually have higher rates of fusion in a rheumatoid arthritis patient. There's recent work by Chris Heyer on first MTP fusions for this. But you do have more complications of our wound healing. So if a patient is adequately treated, you actually get better bony healing but delayed skin healing. So since he wasn't on those current medications, that was not really a concern of mine. And he did state when he came and he had undergone extensive conservative treatment at TOCA, and I took the patient for his word. Certainly I learned something from this in this case that I will ascertain more documentation on that. Certainly I'm in a large orthopedic practice. We see a lot of terrible cases, and his bony pathology, particularly the dorsal navicular cuneiform joint, was substantial, and that was confirmed in both his MRI, and most of his SAG was a bony problem at that point. I did offer him at prior to surgery having a UCBL device made that would support that navicular, but he was concerned about, again, wearing a bulky brace, and that's why we did not undergo a surgical, the UCBL device initially. He wanted something done more from a conservative standpoint. Certainly, when all I treat all my patients the same. In his case, I did have very specific conversations, and I did not document them well enough. In hindsight here, that I told him he would not get back to trail running. If he wanted to go to a jog, that was reasonable, but the trail running, I told him I thought that part of his desire would be over just because of the substantial irritation of the midfoot. And so, my goal, and particularly as a runner, I try to give people realistic expectations. I think that they're in this case, and I think maybe has been seen by the board in our discussions with the patient, both previously and as well as today. I think that there are some key words, I think, that the patient clung on to and kind of ignored some of the other conversations that were being had. In regards to the findings of the posterior and tibial tendon in the operative report, yes, he did have substantial laxity there because that's at the site where his posterior tibial tendon inserts onto the navicular. That's in accordance with the MRI that was obtained preoperatively. There was some tendinosis, but the majority of his problem was laxity secondary to the bony collapse. And so certainly this isn't a normal case of, sometimes in posterior tibial tendon dysfunction, it's mostly a tendon problem. But more often in patients that do have rheumatoid arthritis, it's more of a bony problem that drives. And then the posterior tibial tendon is lax, and that's the main problem is the bone, not the tendon. So I do agree that it's a little bit different, but that's common in our patients that have autoimmune conditions. The nerve damage secondary to the position, I agree. He had a non-union. And when you have a non-union, you're going to have more tension along the nerve. I had sent him to our neurologist, Dr. Nizam. DW had also canceled numerous appointments with him. But we had started him on gabapentin, and my office had also been adequately treating, the nerve damage that was identified postoperatively. And again, a lot of this, of his, initial care post-surgery, was, delayed, I think, secondary to financial issues. And so a lot of the care was attempted, but it wasn't able to be initiated until, funds became available. I think that they have... I think I've addressed most of the...
Wait, pardon me.
Somebody, I think I've addressed...
Dr. Galley, pardon me just a second. Is the complainant still...
Yeah.
Okay, because I heard him. I don't think he's muted.
I was. I took the mute off. I wanted to...
No, pardon me, sir. Sir, you had your opportunity to speak. Mm-hmm. It is Dr. Galley's turn right now. Thank you very much. Dr. Galley?
Okay, but she's telling some inaccuracies.
Pardon me, sir. I ask you once, I won't ask you again. It is Dr. Galley's time, so please, thank you. Dr. Galley, thank you. Go ahead, please.
No, I was just trying to, I think that I have answered most of your concerns. Yes, our billing is vetted through my company. I jotted down bullet points. If I missed any, and if the board has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Can you evaluate your bills before they go out? Your levels that they're charging?
No. We drop. Basically, what we do is we suggest a bill code, and then our billers are there the final say. It doesn't come back to me. There's not a secondary loop.
And on the consent forms, is the only consent that you do, I know you always, in your note, you mentioned that you have the conversation, and then we, the only consents that we see after we have to request them is that they come from the surgery center. And I was looking for the consent on this one. Did you gentlemen see it? I just wanted to review what page it's on.
Yeah, we...
Hang on a second.
That was sent in yesterday.
If I may...
That was sent in yesterday.
I'm sorry, Dr. Galley. We resent the informed consent this morning.
I know, that's from the other case. I'm talking about this case, Mr. King. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is from... No, this is the other case. That's the other case.
I'm just...
Right. Okay. So what I'm trying to get at is, what is the detail like? It's not detailing specific complications. It doesn't detail at hospital, and that's all that is. Okay.
Dr. Kimball.
Yes, ma'am.
Board members, I apologize for the interruption, but Mr. King's assistant did email me the consent form this morning after the meeting had started for this case.
Oh,
So I just received it.
Right. We're correct. Okay.
So I do have it. I can email it.
Right. Thank you.
Now, or I can pass it around.
No, we're on 1924C. Mm-hmm. The one that was sent to us today, this is the 1938C, right?
That's the one in your red travel folders is for the other case, but the one I received via email just 20 minutes ago is for this case.
Okay. So do we have that in?
I don't believe so.
It's not in our packet. That's what I'm asking. I just want to see if it's the same kind of format where it's just very general and very nonspecific as far as complications and risks. Yeah. That's just what they.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So the way it just says. My physician has explained to me the nature, purpose, and possible consequences of each planned operation, procedure, and possible alternative methods of treatment, as well as significant risks involved and possible complications. I understand that the explanation I've received is not exhaustive, and that other more remote risks and consequences may arise. I acknowledge that I've received no guarantee or insurances from anyone as to results that may be obtained. All of my questions have been satisfactorily answered. So that's very generic and broad. So that's concerning because I believe more detailed consent should be presented, because then we have the he said, she said of, yes, I talked about this. It's documented in my progress note, and the complainant or patient will say, well, no, we never talked about that. So I think, diagrams. And so that may be, that may be something that could be addressed in the practice.
Dr. Galley, do you do any kind of diagrams with the patient to show where the hardware will be placed? And
I do it on x-rays in my office. I take their x-rays. I don't have generic, just because I do so many patients that a generic drawing would not, that's not adequate to what their foot looks like when they present. So I will draw out on my x-ray machine, because since we have electronic stuff, I'll draw out and I'll point to where those are. Also, on his March the 7th, 2018 visit, when I reviewed his MRI, after we discussed the surgery and what it entails and the surgical stuff, I did have another consent within my EMR on March the 7th.
Okay. Can you print out what you draw on your EMR?
No.
I mean,
I don't know. Maybe there is a way to do it that our x-ray techs can do, but I have never tried to print it out.
Okay, so if you print it out and draw on the actual...
No, it's not easy.
If you print it out and actually draw on the patient's x-ray and then have them sign it that you went over it, that will be better for chart documentation.
Okay.
Mr. Rhodes, do you have any questions, sir? Okay.
I'm sorry, were you speaking with me?
No. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay, so we've heard from everyone. Again, Mr. King, I'll ask you if you have any remarks to make on behalf of Dr. Galley.
Yes, thank you. Madam President, members of the board, we respectfully submit that Dr. Galley's preoperative workup of this patient, intraoperative care, postoperative care, met the standard of care. When patient complained of pain postoperatively, Dr. Galley referred the patient for pain management to a neurologist and to a spine specialist. She ordered CT scans, x-rays, prescribed physical therapy, which basically the patient abandoned. And therefore, and then when he moved to Virginia, there was no way Dr. Galley, Arizona physician, could cared for him. She properly ordered the bone stimulator, which the patient states did help his bone. And so based on the foregoing, we respectfully ask the board to dismiss this case.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. King. So any other discussion or comments or questions, gentlemen? Well, this definitely is a difficult case. You have, the mechanics are related here, the type of surgery, underlying medical conditions, and I agree with Dr. Cohn's findings that there weren't any violations of state statutes. But I would offer the concerns and put this in the form of offering a letter of concern addressing some better documentation, particularly on operative reports, and better documentation regarding consent forms for surgery with more detailed lists of risk, complications, diagrams that can be in that patient's chart. I realize your conundrum with billing in a large group, but you are the captain of the ship. I would maybe suggest finding some way to review your billing so you know what's going out, because if there's ever maybe an audit, is your employer going to defend you on those billings? And one more point, this is not Dr. Galley, if you ever have another complaint that comes to the board, you need to follow directly the subpoena that you're presented, that all records be included, and that includes the consents, the pathology reports, everything, that because we've had to request those, and that did, previously delay things on the case. So just a point of information to be cognizant of that. So
Dr. Campbell, may I say one
yes,
thing,
sir?
Please? Regarding the production, that was really my office's fault. Dr. Galley did not cause or contribute at all to that. And I just wanted to mention one thing. In Dr. Galley's March 7, 2019 note, she said, had a long discussion with the patient regarding risk, complications, indications, and alternatives to the proposed surgical intervention. We discussed the potential for complications, possible failure of the goals of surgery, and potential need for further surgery in the future. We discussed the risk of complications up to and including death and loss of limb. Thank you.
And I did mention that, Mr. King. We saw that she has that, but as far as if somebody else got a hold of that, in a litigious situation, that there would be discussion about, well, why you didn't say this. It's not detailed out. So does anyone want to second my motion? Do you have any discussion on that?
No.
So I made a motion to offer Dr. Galley a letter of concern regarding the documentation in the report, the billing issue to monitor, to be aware of what there's being billed, and also for development of the consent agreement to be more inclusive. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Oh, and yes, no, I did say there was no violation of state statutes, correct?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. And I appreciate your being so concise time-wise for me. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Is DW still on the line?
I am.
Hi, DW. This is Heather.
Yes, Bodis.
Hi. So this case has been adjudicated by the board, and I will be following up with you. You'll receive correspondence from me shortly.
Well, I want to make some comments.
DW, the case has been completed. The case is over. The board is no longer discussing.
But she lied. You're accepting her lies?
DW, if you would like to speak with me after the meeting, I can contact you. But the case has been completed. The board needs to discuss other items at this time.
All right, please do discuss it with me later, but
I will contact you. So if you could please, if you would like to stay on the line, that's fine, but please let the board continue to move on to other items and mute your phone.
I'm not interested in paying attention to other people's stuff. So I'll leave, but I would appreciate talking with you later. She was inaccurate. She was not being honest.
Thank you, Helen. All right, we will then move on to our next case. Dr. Galley, and this is case number 19-38-C. Dr. Galley is still on the phone. Mr. King is still here. And our investigator on the case is Dr. Cohn. So we'll let Dr. Cohn... Dr. Polikoff, pardon me, proceed with her report.
Good morning, Board. This is Dr. Polikoff on case 1938C, Melissa Galley. I reviewed the complaint from patient... MG. Summary, the patient placed a report or a complaint into the board with concerns of several issues. Just one second. Okay. A practice below the standard of care for surgical long-term complications of nerve damage from surgery. Chart that Dr. Galley presented and the charts from the previous physicians that the patient sought treatment from after Dr. Galley's care all note the nerve involvement. In several places in the chart, Dr. Galley did note that nerve involvement and irritation, pain from the nerve, might not be corrected by the surgery. It was well documented for this. Dr. Galley, as I just stated, well documented the compromised nerves prior to surgery and attempted to make the patient more comfortable. She had a long-standing history, the patient, of an L2-S1 compression, multiple surgeries, and injections. Surgery was also delayed for the foot so that the patient could have some back procedures. Her surgery was to clean up the arthritic changes in the forefoot, remove the neuroma, and fuse the great toe for stability. Unfortunately, she ended up with a non-union, and I have several concerns of the medical records that were lacking information that I'd like to go over for this. I'll turn to the chart from March 29, 2018, page 4. It starts with the neuroma, second web space, and on the left. It goes to the middle of the page, and it says left foot x-rays. X-rays were performed at the Core Institute, film date 3/28/18, views AP lateral oblique. The joint was described as normal. The fracture, no fractures, previous implants, no previous implants. Additional comments, no acute fracture, subsidence, or dislocation. The patient had surgery for bilateral bunion surgeries from Cigna. Unfortunately, she had a complication of the surgery for hallux varus. The reason that the patient went to see Dr. Galley is because the varus was bothering her. So her notes are not complete at all to describe the hallux varus in this area where the x-ray should have been reported. The doctor also billed a 99214 for the visit of 32918 when it was just a repeat of information from prior visits. And as you can see, just in the radiology section, it's not complete at all. In the 32918 visit, the plan is plan of care includes interventions or referrals to address this patient's pain. We discussed the numbness in the first toe is not something that can be fixed. This is longstanding after her index surgery. Moving forward, I discussed removing the second and third metatarsals, she meant the metatarsal heads, along with the second intermetatarsal neuroma. Recovery was described as 2 weeks non-weight-bearing, followed by weight-bearing and post-op shoe. She and her husband expressed understanding and would like to move forward with scheduling. I have concerns with this. The patient is a 75-year-old female, 5'6" tall, 140 pounds, on Prolia, osteoporosis medication. She has been on Prolia for some time. There's no mention in the chart about her osteoporosis from the radiology section. There's no mention in her chart of the other arthritides or a good description of the arthritides of the foot. Surgery was described as being 2 weeks non-weight-bearing. For a 75-year-old osteoporotic having a fusion, that is extremely a short period of time for healing. The patient ended up with a non-union. The patient was told that she will be in a post-op shoe following the fusion where the graft was taken from the calcaneus. In another note, the patient... had for the surgery that was performed on 7/9/18. The surgery was a left first MPJ fusion with a calcaneal autograft, a left flexor hallucis longus contracture and synovectomy, left second neuroma, left second and third met head resection. The patient went on to have extreme pain under the fourth metatarsal head. The fourth metatarsal head in the post-op x-rays is quite prominent because, of course, the second and third metatarsal heads were removed. Having the prominent enlarged fourth metatarsal head, this is where her weight-bearing prominences are now being reflected. So she's having a lot of inversion, eversion rotation because of the non-union of the first and the prominent enlarged fourth metatarsal head. None of this was described on subsequent x-rays. The post-op note of 6/5/18, no change in pain. Patient had pain almost immediately post-op. Advised that surgery would not get rid of numbness to the great toe. She stated that she understood there was numbness to the great toe, but she did not understand why she would have extreme pain to the fourth metatarsal head. On the 3/29/18, worsening pain to the second mets from the day of surgery, according to the patient. On November 10th of 2018, she did have a CT scan, which displayed the non-union, narrowing of the first MTP with bone-on-bone appearance. She went on to see two separate orthopedic surgeons who agreed with the non-union and left MTPJ fusion, which did not address the problems. On the note of the pathology report from the July surgery, it was negative for acute inflammation and malignancy for the neuroma. In conclusion, I feel that the notes are not adequate for the patient's numerous medical, arthritic complications, and that the notes should have been enhanced. In regards of having a fusion of the great toe to correct the varus, with an osteoporotic patient on Prolia, there are other procedures that I feel could have helped the patient more expeditiously and with less post-operative discomfort, such as a plain old-fashioned Keller. In regards to removal of the second and third metatarsal heads, the complication of the fourth metatarsal head, which is enlarged anyway, being the primary weight force of the forefoot, should have been examined preoperatively, and a Hoffman-Clayton would have performed better for a patient like this, because all the metatarsals and the metatarsal parabola could have been rebuilt for weight bearing, instead of just having the second and third removed and having an abnormal metatarsal parabola of now the fourth and fifth. In conclusion, I find that the documentation needs to be improved. The planning for surgery needs to be improved. Does the board have any questions?
Yes, I do, Dr. Povlakoff. There was indication of the issue of, you mentioned about the weight-bearing at 2 weeks, or non-weight-bearing for 2 weeks, then weight-bearing at 2 weeks, so we're 4 weeks post-op, right?
We are. Recovery, which was described as 2 weeks non-weight-bearing, followed by weight-bearing in post-op shoe. So that means 2 weeks.
Right. And the beginning of the physical therapy was about 5 weeks post-op?
The physical therapy was at 5 weeks, yes.
There was description on the visit of 10-12-18 regarding that the patient was having burning pain on the bottom of the left foot, and there was mention of possible CRPS, but I didn't find any description of the lower extremity that could have led to that conclusion other than the pain, but I also did not see any consideration that there could have possibly been a stump neuroma as a possibility of this patient's pain. My other question to you, is regarding, there had been discussion too later about consideration of using scholastic implants in the second and third MPJs with removal, of course, of the base of the proximal phalanx. And what's your opinion? I mean, here we have a patient with rheumatoid arthritis and osteoporosis that a scholastic implant would not really be appropriate or hold up well.
I agree. You're just adding more surgical hardware and complication risk to a patient who has already diminished in her ambulatory status. That's why I suggested something like a Hoffman-Clayton would have maintained a parabola so at least the patient can ambulate.
And of course, back to the fusion too of that first metatarsal. Okay, the patient already had the bunionectomy, and it was noted that there was like on the 50% articulation of the joint at that time. So as far as the ability of a fusion to take when you have less or at 50% articulation, what's your opinion?
No, I thought it was an inappropriate planning procedure to do a fusion on a 75-year-old osteoporotic patient who's already had scar tissue and a varus procedure in the area with bone on bone.
Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Polo?
No, the answer
no.
I just noted one thing that Dr. Galley had discussed and assessed the rheumatoid arthritis with MG at that day. It was noted in the report. That was on the May 5th, 2017. So, I mean, it had been addressed, the rheumatoid arthritis.
I see that, but in the radiology report, they could have had more description, except films were taken.
And, of course, we all know that the patient had previous lumbar fusion and radiculopathy issues, too. So, and we do not have the complainant on the phone, correct? Make sure I've addressed questions I had for. And oh, when they were postoperatively talking about the nerve irritation on the medial aspect of the hallux, again, Dr. Galley did notice, had noted that previously in her notes, and had discussed that with her, with the patient. So, and we did get the PATH report, which Dr. Polakoff addressed, and again, the consent agreement, or the consent form at the surgery center, which again, like we discussed, it's a very general description of the possible risks and complications. So we did receive that. So, Dr. Galley, if you would proceed with your remarks, please. Dr. Galley?
Yes. Sorry, I was unmuting myself.
Oh, okay. So
when I received this patient's complaint, there was really not a specific complaint addressed. So I don't know if some of these were directly more from the investigation brought up. But after this patient saw the other providers, she never returned to my office, and I guess I didn't have a chance to address some of these directly with the patient. As always, that's the way I like to discuss any issues, obviously, before it gets to a board level. So that's thing number one. I do think that anytime someone has a varus deformity in the office, yes, a Keller is an option, but you can also, patients can feel like that's a floppy toe. It's not something that is stable for them. And so if someone also with back problems, I tend to opt more for a fusion. And if they're well controlled under their on Prolia and they're getting active treatment, that's the osteoporotic patient that I will consider doing a fusion on that patient. A lot of my conversation goes to, do they want to have another surgery or not down the line? If you have a Keller, you can feel like you're tripping. You can, that's not necessarily the end procedure. And so for patients that are older that are wanting to be able to get up in ambulatory, I often suggest, if they're well controlled on their medications, a first metatarsophalangeal joint fusion, because you can walk them so early, and with the hardware there, even if they have a pseudoarthrosis, even if it goes to a non-union, you can usually get that union will take a long time to achieve, and I certainly tell them that is the, from a balance standpoint, on somebody that already has back problems, I prefer to give them a stable first ray. And so that's why the procedure was chosen in this case. As far as a Hoffman Clayton versus a Hoffman 2-3, I really evaluate the foot and decide if the 4 and 5 are necessary, because most of her neuritic pain didn't involve the 4th and 5th met heads. We discussed pros and cons, and we decided to just remove the 2nd and the 3rd, not address the 4th and the 5th. And certainly with back-to-back cases today, a lot of the concerns on my company, the surgical consent that we put into our in the computer is standard. Since both of these cases have come up in my personal practice, I have changed the consent. I have a much longer consent that I include in all my patients. Again, I've been in practice for 6 years, and getting two of these back-to-back complaints has been an eye-opener. Some of those concerns that as addressed in the last case and in this case, I've already addressed in my practice. Humbly apologize for taking your guys' time.
Dr. Galley, this is Dr. Campbell. I have a question. Looks like you send the patients to a podiatrist in the facility to do the casting. Do you write the prescription, or does the podiatrist?
Caveat, when this patient came to our practice, we had a podiatrist in a practice. I write the prescription, and then the podiatrist would see the patient, sometimes modify it. If they wanted to modify it, then I would sign off on it based upon what their evaluation. Those would be then shipped out. They would get custom molded, and they would come back and get fitted by the orthotist. We had some major issues with the timeliness, and then the really good pet orthotist that came to our office left that group, and we got a really bad one. So we have since severed the ties with that pet orthotist, and we no longer have in-house orthotics. But at the time of this patient, we did.
So it seems like there's a, you know, maintaining control over your treatment of your patient can be definitely an issue here. Because do you then, when they do the casting, do you get to evaluate their cast to see if it's done correctly?
The casting for just an orthotic was done via computer. It was a computerized type.
Oh,
so they
like
didn't actually
like
cast.
A Tomcat.
It was something we needed to control. Yes, yes. For hind foot and ankle stuff, then that casting, no. I was the pet orthotist actually came to our office on a day that I'm in surgery, so I did not have control over it. I was in charge actually of Core's DME when we started the custom casting program, because we had such bad patient complaints from patients going to Hanger when we didn't have the ability to do it in-house. So we brought somebody in-house, and then we just had a different type of complaint because it would take too long or billing or whatever. So then that tie was severed. So yes, in a large practice, orthotic stuff is one of the most agonizing parts of my practice, and lack thereof of control.
So did you ever consider, I don't know if you answered this part, about the patient having a stump neuroma and then your concern about possible regional pain syndrome?
So stump neuromas, I always discuss with patients preoperatively that a stump neuroma can happen. Her symptoms started, they were kind of no longer in the forefoot, but on a patient that has such bad lumbar pathology, you have multiple confounding variables. We discussed the possibility of a stump neuroma, but I also wanted to make sure that we had exhausted all other treatment. And then, like I said, after our discussions on those things, then she never came back to me.
Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions
for
Dr. Gallagher? No. Mr. Rhodes, do you have any questions?
Yes. I just wanted to say a couple of things. Referring to the October 12th office visit. Let me pull that up. Dr. Galley was worried about possible nerve involvement, and so she ordered auto-inflammatory labs, hemoglobin A1C to evaluate if there was any systemic pathology that could be contributing to the hypersensitivity. And then she asked her to follow up in 1 week, and they were going to do a local anesthetic injection. And if this continued, she was going to refer her to a pain management doctor, which in fact did occur. It's on November 21st, 2018. We'll get a referral to Dr. Paulette's pain management to evaluate for sympathetic nerve. And Dr. Gailey also prescribed a phone stimulator for this patient. In Arizona, the fact that one physician may prescribe a particular procedure for a patient and another physician may say, no, I want to do this other procedure, the inquiry is whether it's reasonable for both physicians to do a procedure in the way that they want to. And I respectfully assert that here it was reasonable for Dr. Gailey to perform the surgery the way that she did, and that she properly followed this patient, did a proper workup preoperatively, tried conservative measures, saw this patient frequently, ordered a pain management, and ordered a bone stimulator. And so we're respectfully asking the board to dismiss this case. Thank you.
I see no violations of size.
And we've offered, I'm seeing this, you know, again, and I know Dr. Gailey said she's done some changes in her practice regarding the consents and detail on that. I also, you know, here we have the same issue again with the billing and the coding. Understand, you know, every physician has the ability to choose their procedure that they feel will be best for their patient. I agree with that statement. I think, you know, it's we just go back here again to the documentation issue of the risks and the complications. And Dr. Gailey said she's working on that. So, I agree that there were no violations of state statutes, but I'm just, again, are at that if a second letter of concern for the same issue.
Sure. I mean, the letter of concern for that should be good. I mean, it's her second violation, and she's already referenced that concern that she's changing her ways. So, just another second letter of concern. I see no violations.
Can we combine those letters of concern?
No, they're separate complaints. So,
you have to make the motion.
I make the motion to make the letter of concern. To dismiss the letter of concern, and also there's no violations.
Dr. Yolano has moved that the case be dismissed as seeing no violations of state statutes, but including a letter of concern regarding the issues of the billing documentation and consent.
Second.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Can I just ask a follow-up question really fast?
Pardon me?
Is there, with the letter of concern, after I go back and try to get the follow-up with my practice to get some of this stuff hardwired, can I respectfully respond to the letter to you guys, or how does that process?
I will have our Assistant Attorney General address that to you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, the letter of concern is basically an advisory letter. There's no reason to respond to it.
So it's been moved.
Okay.
Any more discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? So moved. Now, Dr. Gailey, we appreciate the fact that you're making those changes, so that hopefully will prevent other issues for you in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Okay, we'll take a 10-minute recess. Thank you. Start again. All righty. Back on record at 10:56. Our next complaint case is 19-42-C. I'm going to call you Vanny Dandahari. And her attorney, Mr. Crawford, is present. Our investigator is Dr. Polakoff. And have a complaint on the phone, Heather. Background noise.
Hi, this is Heather Broaddus. Is the complainant for case number 1942C present on the phone?
Yes, GE's online.
So as soon as the board is ready to hear from you, they will call you. So if you could just mute your phone until that time, that would be appreciated.
Thank you.
Dr. Polakoff, ma'am.
Good morning, board. This is 1942C, Dr. Gandhari. The patient, GE, filed a complaint against Dr. Gandhari after sustaining a foot injury from falling from his bicycle. He was hit by a car. He went to the emergency room where they attempted to close reduce the area. They gave him a crutches and referred him to the office for follow-up care. GE has five allegations, and I will list them. Number one, provider directed PT activities on November 26, 2019 that were called out by second provider as misdirected treatment based on healing schedule and decision-making not supported by MRI test data document. Number two, patient GE was forced to walk on bare floor on his right foot without his protective boot on the 12/9/2019 visit, approximately 50 feet from the treatment room to the x-ray, which further injured and injured his foot. Number three, provider was unaware of GE's physical, medical, status, and mobility support made on 12/9/2019 based on previous direction given on 11/26/19. Provider attempted to physically realign fifth toe based on x-ray subluxation data on 12/9/2019 and did not follow up physical realignment with post-alignment x-ray to verify adjusted position. And number five, retaliatory action to involuntarily discharge assigned medical treatment to mask above missteps and remove herself from liability in violation of the patient bill of rights. The patient was terminated from the office. And the last one was that the patient states that the office is not in compliance with ADA requirements. The patient presented those in his letter of concern to the board. The doctor had a response for allegation number one. The patient was not forced to perform any task in Dr. Gandhari's office. Yes, after removal of the cam to examine the foot, GE did walk to the x-ray unit approximately 10 feet away from the treatment room. Allegation number two. The medical records do display appropriate patient education instructions for use of cam and knee scooter, instructions for non-weight-bearing and eventual transition to assisted weight-bearing with cam, followed by PT to aid in muscle strength for eventual return to full independent weight-bearing. Number three, allegation, the doctor did respond to the request for pain medications. A prescription was calling for diclofenac, elevation, icing, and compression socks. The doctor was in surgery at the time when the patient called in for pain medications. The doctor did respond to the patient's concern for pain medications the next morning. The doctor noted that if the patient's concerns were not addressed, he was always welcome to call back to the office, and there were two other physicians in attendance that could have addressed his medication needs. Allegation number four, the doctor provided pictures with the use of a wheelchair demonstrating that her office is in ADA compliance. Allegation number five, the doctor wrote that the last encounter with GE was on 12/9/2019. At that time, minimal subluxation was observed. The digit was splinted in the position to prevent additional subluxation. By use of a tall cam walker, it is designed to offload the forefoot. Therefore, if GE was fully compliant with his WBAT ambulation in the cam walker and not walking barefoot, no subluxation would have occurred. And the last allegation is the physicians always reserve the right to discharge a patient. The patient was issued a termination letter, which included the names of other physician groups that he might choose for a smooth transition of care. His medical records and a CD of his x-rays were provided for the patient. In review of the injuries sustained after he was initially seen on Dr. Ganhari's office, the subluxation and fracture were in an extremely hard place for normal healing. Subluxation to the lesser digits is inherently unstable. It is hard to treat, and fusing the area for possible treatment or other treatment modalities has its own inherent risk and complications that might prevent the patient from pursuing his exercise endeavors. Unfortunately, this is a very hard case to heal from. The best choice of treatment is what Dr. Ganhari did perform, which was stabilization and splinting. Further treatments are down the line, but cannot be evaluated until further evaluation of how the stability is with just attempting initial healing for 6 months to a year with splinting. The doctor did note in her charts on numerous occasions how to use the cam walker, minimal ambulation without splinting or without his crutches or scooter. It was noted that the patient did walk in without the use of his crutches in the chart. Very minimal subluxation was noted on the 12/9/2019 visit. The digit was splinted in position to prevent additional subluxation. A close reduction with local anesthetic was not done and did not warrant the need for post-reduction x-rays. I did go back to the patient's notes of 12/9/2019, and I saw no indication that a additional subluxation post-reduction was performed. At this time, I found unsubstantiated allegations, and I did attempt to have a one-on-one interview with GE. We did connect when I was driving, and I did explain to him that I could not talk to him at that time because I was on my way to a medical visit for my husband. But I would arrange a 3 o'clock visit, which I did attempt to make with him, and I did leave two other phone messages, but unfortunately GE and I did not connect on the phone. At this time, does the board have any questions?
Yes, Dr. Polkoff, I do. I noticed on the subsequent visits that GE had, number one, with Dr. Sue on 12/27/19, Dr. Sue noted that the patient was bearing weight without a limp and had no pain in the right foot. Also noted that when he went to the visit with Dr. Jason Patterson on 1/17/20, indicated that the complainant had denied that the toes were not taped, but as you previously mentioned, Dr. G had gone ahead and the 3, 4, and 5 toes were taped. So there's some contraindication here, obviously, in what the patient remembers.
I agree.
Anyone do you have any questions?
All right, sir, we will give you your time here, GE, to give your summary, and if you could keep that between 5 to 10 minutes, we'd appreciate it. And then my board members will have the opportunity to ask you any questions, so please proceed.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. The real issue I have is being involuntarily discharged based on my complaint. Yeah, thank you. So I find this as being retaliation, which is in violation of my patient bill of rights. It's called out in both the Arizona state statute and also the federal government statute. So that's my main concern, being sent to a second provider. Being sent to the second provider, I did tell him that I was under PT care or physical therapy care, and he basically stated that that was inappropriate for me to be subjected to PT that soon after my accident. I went to my first PT session approximately 30 days after my accident, which was on 11/26 was my first PT session. So based on his input, the subluxation was caused by the PT, which was premature, based on his inputs from Dr. Sue. And then also I do have concerns with regards to the minor realignment that was conducted on the 9th as a function of not verifying any type of movement that was produced by the realignment effort. So I have concerns with that. And that's basically my statement.
And what was that date you last were discussing? You said about the realignment. What date that was?
It was on 12/9/19.
Okay. And when was your initial injury, the accident?
It was on 10/26/19. I'm sorry.
Pardon me.
10/23.
Okay, thank you.
10/23. My mistake.
Addressing the issue of rights. Referring to some state statutes. All righty, just a second. Do any of my board members have questions?
When you were discharged, how many doctors you were given to see?
You mean in the discharge document?
Yes. Were you given any doctors to see?
Not specific. Well, actually, just offices. Not specific doctors, but.
And how many offices were given?
Four.
Four. And in your doing your PT, were you weight bearing on this or non weight bearing? They were performing PT.
Well, I was wearing my soft boot, so I was taking the soft boot was taken off each session, and then I was given physical therapy treatments.
Okay. Was it weight bearing, non weight bearing?
Oh, non weight bearing, yes.
So it was just. Would you say it was like range of motion exercises?
Range of motion, and then they used stretching exercise, which was against my fifth toe, kind of like an elastic stretch, if you will, which I thought was kind of inappropriate at the time because that's where my injury was. So that occurred before my visit on the 9th, and then upon my visit on 12/9 is when the subluxation was discovered.
No further questions.
Do you have any questions, sir? Let me just double check. I want to ask you about your concern about that your pain medication wasn't given to you. So the doctor did respond to you. She had a busy clinic day. And, I mean, if you did you feel that you didn't take the opportunity, if you felt your pain was severe enough that you could call back to the office as there are other doctors in the office that could have helped you?
I called in the morning, approximately 9:30, 10 o'clock. They should have sufficient backup to provide any type of script writing.
Well, they do. There's two other doctors in the office.
I know. So why didn't they respond?
Because if you initially had addressed to your doctor, Dr. G, that she did respond, she was in surgery and had the busy clinic, and if you hadn't, you know, if you were having issues, I would have imagined that you would have called back if you hadn't heard, and as stated, there's two other doctors in the office.
So it's my obligation to call back every hour to get my pain medication that was requested already?
No, I don't believe that's that. You know, that's a little much, but...
And what's the expectation here?
Pardon me?
What's the expectation here? Right, I call, I requested pain medication. It wasn't provided until the next day.
We'll talk about that with Dr. G. So, no other questions for the complainant? Okay, thank you. So, you need to put that on mute because that's all right. Now, Dr. G, Mr. Crawford. Do you want to speak first, Mr. Crawford, or do you prefer that we hear from Dr.
G first? No, I'll say a couple brief things. Bruce Crawford. I advised the doctor to discharge Mr. E. He was rude to the staff, and he accused the doctor of medical neglect. In my judgment at that point, the physician-patient.
Mr. Crawford, can I ask you for your feeling or remark about the patient bill of rights being? Dr. G, please pronounce your last name for so we all have it correct.
Gandhari.
So, don't like to butcher people's names, so. Please continue.
I'm available.
Most medical offices, medication response is usually 24 to 48 hours, so. Because it was noted it was mild, right? Mr. Rhodes, do you have any questions?
I'll make a motion to dismiss 1942C, finding no violations of state statutes in items, allegations 1 through 5.
Do I have a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you very much. Heather, could you?
Hi, GE, are you still on the phone?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Heather Broaddus. So the board has completed its review of this case, so you'll be getting some correspondence from me within a day or two. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to speak with you after the meeting. But at this point, your case is adjudicated and you're free to leave the call.
Thank you, Heather. All righty. We will move on now to case 1944-B, which is Dr. Devin Bland. His attorney, Mr. Flynn Carey, is also present. So, gentlemen, have a seat. Okay, so just a moment. Is that one not working? Oh. Heather, do you want to summarize this? This is what we want to make it.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. This case was originally heard in mid-December. It's regarding correspondence that was received from the hospital that Dr. Bland was employed at. The board at that time determined to open a complaint and it did come before the board a few months ago, and then we were asked to obtain some additional information from the hospital, and at that time as well, the licensee's attorney, Dr. Bland, his attorney, Mr. Carey, also requested a continuance, so it's back before the board. Basically, this is going to be not an initial analysis, but just a continuation from the December meeting. So that's just a brief summary. I can answer any questions. I know Dr. Bland and his attorney, Mr. Carey, is present.
And I don't mean to speak out of turn, but I can. There is a procedural actual correction on this because I think we have two matters, one that is still pending investigation and then one that's before the board.
Right, this is case.
It's the 44.
44B.
My recollection is we opened it on an emergent, or it was heard on an emergent basis to determine if there was any immediate need taken, and then it was put into the normal queue for investigation. And so we didn't actually, our continuance that was we moved for was in the 40 matter at the meeting in February, I want to say January or February.
That was probably my miss.
This is something that both Heather and I are, because we were working on both cases, I think the only confusion was that procedurally we had the emergency meeting, you voted to open, we responded in due course, and then we're adjudicating today the Tuba City complaint lodged by Dr. Sorrentino in or around December. That's the today, and then my assumption, depending on how soon it will come report, will be the other matter, which would be either April or May.
Right. Yeah, so we received the information then from Tuba City, which was in regard to let's get all the issues here. Hang on. So they performed their internal investigation on the complaint regarding initially it was the DUI case that had been dismissed due to some issues with the way things were handled, and then that was brought to the attention of Tuba City, I believe, with Dr. Gaw. Part of the process of the passing of information to Dr. Sorrentino, and the questions were that Dr. Bland was on call for a surgery, or had done surgery on a patient and had taken gone to Flagstaff and was on call and was not responsive to a call from the hospital regarding a patient. There were they eventually contacted Dr. Gaughan. He came up from Phoenix to attend to the patient. He also had attempted to call Dr. Bland and eventually was able to speak with him. And Dr. Bland remained in Flagstaff to take care of the situation. He was involved with an accident. So eventually then this all came to fruition. Dr. Sorrentino, who is the, he's the CEO, it's his title, I can never. Anyway, he was in touch with Dr. Glasser, who is the CMO. They did their internal investigation, which took time. The original letter that we received from the board was dated 9/30/19, and it was received in the board office in December. So that was eventually, or that had to do with that time frame where they were doing their due diligence in investigating this case. So they had their committees met and came up with their findings, and the performance review committee met several occasions, I believe, and they were offering, to Dr. Bland was put on administrative leave while this was occurring, correct? And then he was eventually terminated from the hospital, and I believe there was a resignation. Dr. Bland He resigned on 11/15/19. Peer review was mailed out on 11/14/19. And they had found several other concerns that were not originally anything that we knew about, obviously. Those we have in your packets. You'll see the evaluation, what the committee found. Their thoughts were such, there were some issues with, the rules of their policies of the hospital is that when you're on call, you are no more than 30 minutes away from the hospital. They're concerned about drinking while you are on call. That violates their drug and alcohol policy. Time and attendance policy was violated as far as the distance they were. They had concerns about there were some issues with medical records and being able to save notes. They felt patient care was compromised. There was some discussion of the performance of surgery on a significant other, which we had, that was in a previous discussion too, that is not something that is against policy, but they felt maybe that was not the best procedure to take. Again, there was some discrepancy in deficiencies in keeping up with charting, and I believe Dr. Bland finally did address all those issues. Am I missing anything else? I think, kind of in a nutshell, that is where we are with this. So, do you have, we'll go ahead and then ask Mr. Flynn for a statement here. And we know, that doctor has gone and, as per the request of Mr. Carey, that he attended a professionalism course and also went to an alcohol and drug education course. Oh, Mr. Carey.
Thank you. President Campbell, members of the board, I'd like to start and have Dr. Bland make a brief statement, and then I have some follow-up, if that's appropriate. Thank you.
Members of the board, Madam Chair, I've prepared a statement today I'd like to share. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you today. I sit here embarrassed and humbled to be before the board today dealing with this complaint. This process in the evening of the accident have shown me how quickly things can change based on one decision. Over the last six months, I've reflected on the events that occurred during my time at Tuba City and the results from my accident. I recognize that I should have remained near Tuba City when I was on call. I recognize that being on call should be treated the same as being at work, and I made a poor decision when I chose to leave. I compounded that decision further when I had a beer with dinner. I appreciate also the fact that the reason it was important for me to be readily available on call rather than traveling to another city was because unpredictable things can happen that would make me unavailable. For example, even if the accident hadn't occurred, I could have had car trouble, got stuck in freeway traffic, along with many other occurrences that could have prevented me from being able to complete my on-call responsibilities. I hope that the board believes that my actions were out of character. I've never traveled that far while being on call. I've never consumed alcohol while being on call. I recognize that all it takes is one instance in which someone does something out of the ordinary to create a significant problem, and I'm embarrassed about what occurred. For a time, because I was doing call without additional compensation and being required to take on additional responsibilities without any adjustments to my title, my pay, or my standing in Tuba City, I was resentful for the year and a half that this had gone on. I felt like I had no say in how my career was progressing, and I think those feelings of helplessness contributed to my decisions. This event definitely was a wake-up call, and it showed me that I was unhappy with the state of my career or circumstances, and that it's my responsibility to communicate that to my employer to make changes. I reach those conclusions through the significant personal and professional work I have done on myself since last summer. That was alluded to through the professional course that I took with the boundaries. I've taken steps to better educate myself and become a better version of who I used to be. I've enrolled in ethics and professionalism training. The program itself was 28 hours in person. I currently am enrolled in ongoing weekly telephone communication and will be so for the next 6 months. I've learned so much about how seeming minor decisions can have significant effects on my practice. I recognize we all face stress and frustration and other feelings that arise as a normal part of being a professional, but that there are strategies for addressing those feelings in a more productive way. I also learned how to be more thoughtful about risk management situations. I recognize that one of the allegations made by Tuba City is that I treated someone with whom I had a relationship. While I took some steps to determine if it was appropriate to treat her, I also recognize that even if it was permitted, it may not be the best decision from a risk management standpoint. The course I took helped me better evaluate those situations and make sure that I am not only meeting the standard of care, but exceeding it when possible. I also recognize that the mere fact that there was an allegation involving alcohol is sufficient for me to obtain additional education. Although my DUI allegation was dismissed, I still went through a 16-hour course of alcohol education. I learned a great deal from the program and recognize that there is no safe amount of alcohol when driving or engaged in other important tasks. I vow to you that I never have consumed alcohol before or during work or since the DUI charge. I have abstained completely. While I don't feel I have an alcohol issue, there's so many other things in my life that simply are more important to me than alcohol. Overall, this entire situation has made me reevaluate my practice and my mindset. And while I'm not proud of the choices that I made, I feel that I am a better practitioner now. I cannot take back the decision that I made while being on call, but I've learned so much, and I'm a more well-rounded provider now. And for that, I'm truly sorry.
President Campbell, members of the board, the allegations that were initially made are different than ultimately what the MEC and the hospital came back with. One of the things that I noted is that the bases for actions were significantly reduced after the internal committees reviewed it. I refer to Dr. Sorrentino's letter to Dr. Bland. It covers a much smaller scale than what they discussed during the committee. The allegations here ultimately were the concern of alcohol use on call, the instance of not rounding, the charting issue, and then the issues that were reported to the board included the issues regarding his significant other. In regards to the alcohol allegation, we note that the alcohol consumption that's being alleged here didn't result in a DUI conviction. That complaint was dismissed. However, I think Dr. Bland has shown through his statement and through his efforts that he has an appreciation for why being on call is identical to being at work. There's no indication anywhere in the materials from the board that this is an ongoing issue, that there's an issue of under the unprofessional code of habitual intemperance. The reality is if in the materials from the committees, the only alcohol-related incident cited is this incident. This is an outlier. The personnel records do not include for-cause testing, any other issues of concerns about him being impaired while at work. We also note that Dr. Bland had a history of working very effectively on call. He was uncompensated for a year and a half by Tuba City on call, being back at the hospital every time he was needed. So this is not someone who has any history of violating any of the rules while on call, and we have plenty of data points to confirm that. In the failing to round allegation made by Dr. Sorrentino and the committee, there are two instances. Obviously, the instance on the evening where he was in the accident created a situation in which he was unable to attend to his duties at the hospital. We would note two things in that regard, and this is not by way of excuse, but by way of consideration and mitigation. First of all, there's an ortho that's also on call at the same time. And in fact, one of the things that Tuba City has done is they have essentially removed the podiatrist being on call, and the orthopedic surgeon is covering essentially any of the on-call duties. That's a change that's been made, but there was an ortho that was on call. If you consult the schedules in the other matter, you can actually see back last year an ortho being scheduled at the same time. So there was someone local. The other thing I'd ask you to consider is the Sorrentino complaint that triggered our emergency hearing wasn't sent in until December. So that should call into question whether the actions in June in fact were of such a point where they did cause patient harm or place someone seriously at risk. The delay was several months, and that should inform the fact that the hospital did have the ability to care for this patient. As for this, there's this allegation of July 13th regarding failing to round. We've provided the phone records. We've provided names and information about the people that Dr. Bland reached out to for help with the charting process. We also provided you the charts that were outstanding upon his separation from service, and that is a significantly reduced number. It's not 200 charts. It is a significantly smaller number of charts that were there, and a lot of those issues, as you can see from the post-it note and the other documentation, are insurance-related issues, which is handled by billing. As for the surgery and narcotics issue, the issue here is twofold. In regarding the surgery, Dr. Bland took significant steps to determine whether or not he legally could perform that surgery. He also did it in the sunlight. He put her on the schedule. She had pre-op visits, post-op visits. She was on the schedule. The surgeons were aware of who she was. This is not a situation in which this was done covertly. This wasn't him being in a clinic covertly treating someone. This is him treating her like a normal patient in this situation. From a risk management perspective, I agree. It's not strategically a good choice, but we don't base our unprofessional conduct on risk management. It's based upon the statutes and the regulations, and it's not prohibited by the statutes or the regulations. I have yet to see a policy from Tuba City either that they have been able to cite to where this is not permitted. In their discussion, they talk about the concerns about it, but I haven't seen them been able to specifically identify how this violates their procedures. So I think there is a due process issue there. I won't get into too much of the legal analysis on the immediate family term that the podiatry board has. I recognize that that's a product of legislation. The nursing board is more explicit about this. As you saw, the DO board and some of the other boards go further to define relationships that are prohibited or not prohibited. We take the boards as we find them, the statutes that you have to work with. There's no violation there, even if, you know, it may be something that an individual board member may choose not to do. There's no violation there. The other thing, just to close the loop on that patient, there's no allegation whatsoever that anything he did in actually treating that patient fell below the standard of care. And in fact, she had had prior surgeries that led to Dr. Bland being requested to be involved to fix what were perceived to be errors or shortcomings of previous surgeries. Finally, I think Dr. Bland has demonstrated through a significant number of proactive measures that he is someone who can be taught. He can learn. He has done the PBI course. If I don't know the board members' experience with the other boards, like the medical board or DO, PBI is considered to be the gold standard. It's what the doctors and DO, MDs and DOs are sent to for education. He did an inpatient, or I'm sorry, an in-person course over multiple days, and he has signed up for the teleconferences, which are check-ins every typically every Wednesday, where the participants are expected to do homework and conference ethical and professional issues. He also did the 16 hours of DUI education. It's an opportunity for people to understand greater implications of how alcohol can affect people. I think what we're seeing is this is someone who has drawn significantly different boundaries now and made significant inroads professionally. I would ask, based on the totality of the circumstances, the board consider a non-disciplinary outcome here. The board has, of course, the authority to dismiss, the authority to issue a letter of concern. If the board were truly concerned about the necessary for documentation, it has the ability to do a non-disciplinary consent agreement. It has a requirement to require him to finish the teleconferences and hold him accountable in that way. It has a lot of tools available to it. What I would submit, though, is that this was an aberrant situation, and probably in a situation that is really unless unlikely or unable for anyone to really duplicate the accident, just the circumstances altogether. So we would ask to consider his overall history, his lack of discipline, and give him an opportunity to prove to the board that this will not be a future issue.
I have a question. Dr. Bland, are you currently practicing?
I am not.
Do you have plans for your practice life?
I do. As far as moving forward with my professional life, I wanted to make sure that these issues that have been ongoing for the past 6 months were absolutely addressed. And before I would consider practicing in the future, I wanted to make myself better. By doing so, I reached out to the PBI. It's the Professional Boundaries course. And I did that by my own free will and choice. Secondarily to that, I did the Scottsdale Training Institute alcoholism course, 16 hours, by my own free will and choice.
In that course, were you evaluated by a clinician?
I did not need an evaluation per their request, because the DUI had been dismissed.
In your DUI course that you took, did they discuss with in their curriculum any percentage of people who relapsed and had issues?
They did.
And what was that information?
According to their information, it was 10 to 15%.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Campbell, the course... Oh, I'm sorry.
Please.
The course that Dr. Bland took was education-based. The reason for that is when someone gets charged with DUI, regardless of whether or not they have an actual diagnosis or this is an aberrant behavior, court order requires a minimum of 16 hours of education. And so what typically occurs is the Scottsdale Treatment Institute or any other provider will look at the citation typically and order a number of hours of education. It's not rehabilitative in the sense that it is to take someone who necessarily has an alcohol addiction or substance abuse issue. It's educational in nature. It's essentially prophylactic to prevent someone from being in a DUI situation in the future. So I understand the nature of the questions, and they certainly do. The education does talk about the disease of substance abuse. His focus was educational in nature because there's not been a diagnosis that he has a substance abuse issue at this time, especially given that there is no other instances of any kind of alcohol abuse or alcohol use in relation to his job, for instance.
Dr. Foreman, Dr. Yolano, comments or questions?
I feel as though he's helped himself through most of this, and with the DUI being dismissed, I feel that he's reached the next stage.
Yeah. You know, in regards to the question I ask about the possibility of reoccurrence of an issue, even though this has been discussed as being an aberrant issue that was only as a one-time thing, and when somebody says, I'm never going to do this again, how do we know? Do we order an evaluation? Offer a disciplinary an interim consent agreement where we ask for a substance abuse evaluation and have that be our document. If the substance abuse physician says, I see no issue here, then fine. But I hope that this is not the issue here, that there isn't going to be a recurrence, but I have some reservations in that regard. I also understand non-disciplinary from the fact that the doctor has done addressing some issues with the professionalism and ethics, and again on alcohol education. I still, and you know, continuing those kind of CMEs. I know we set up to do the monthly, you know, follow up and things. If he's not practicing, I don't think there's any need to do any kind of practice restriction. But I still go back to the basic. That he was drinking when he was on call. He wasn't the only person in that car either when he was driving. So that's my thought. Thank you, Lionel.
For me, I was glad and good to hear your statement. I felt it was real. I felt you have grown and learned from this event. I also applaud your realization that what happened. I believe everyone needs a second chance. I deserve a second chance. And I make the motion for...
Mr. Rhodes, we have to... I'd just
like to commend you for getting some alcohol education. But, in reading all this, I was going to ask, were there any underlying issues previously that you and Dr. Sorrentino had problems with each other?
To be very honest in that matter, Dr. Sorrentino and I have a great rapport. Dr. Sorrentino had been the second chief medical officer with whom I'd worked. He was fairly new to the position, as was I. I took over the department at a time when it was in great disarray. Of course, as Mr. Carey alluded to, these are not excuses in any form or fashion. These are just facts that supported the surrounding evidence. There was such stress and I don't know if it's better as well. There was such stress and high level of patient volume that both he and I were doing the very best that we could. I have a great deal of respect for Dr. Sorrentino in that capacity.
I do have another question. There was a comment made that about you didn't report the incident of the DUI to Tuba City, the gentleman, an RN, that there was no report to them? comment on that, please.
Well, first of all, I would note that Dr. Gao was immediately contacted so that coverage could be arranged. And this is not something that any secret was made. I believe also Dr. Bland did consult the handbook for what the reporting requirements are. Typically, and it's been my experience, that conviction tends to be the trigger point on a lot of these. If it's a patient injury, if it's something related to patient care, or anything like a fraud with Medicare, anything like that, those typically are immediately reported. What I've seen generally is the standard is either upon application or at the time of a conviction. And there was no conviction in this case. Once the issue was reported to Gao, though, obviously it went through the normal chain of command and Gao did report internally. At that point, Dr. Bland was very transparent about the fact that there was a charge pending regarding the DUI.
So, more discussion? Our decision then... Here is obviously, there's no need to do any restriction of practice. There's no harm to the public ensuing. But the decision is this non-disciplinary or disciplinary at this point? Yes, I'm glad to see, too, that he's been proactive, and you heard what my other opinion was, so that I always have concern about relapse, and hopefully that will not happen, and that he's learned and moved on, and I also agree that people do need second chances. So.
I would also note under the board's own rules and the board's norms of practice that if you were to issue a letter of concern or something of an advisory, non-disciplinary nature, it can be used to aggravate penalties in future cases. So if, for instance, something were to appear before this board, you would be able to immediately establish knowledge and also aggravation for a case involving similar situations.
Yes, I'm aware of that. And things can always progress to other things if things happen. So if we offer a non-disciplinary, would it be an interim? We could do a non-disciplinary interim consent.
Yes, the Madam Chair, board members, you do have the option to ask if they would be willing to enter into an interim consent agreement for a substance abuse evaluation. Dispose of the case based on.
But that would be considered disciplinary to do the not to do a substance abuse evaluation.
No, that would be not disciplinary. The board has the
that option to have it.
The board has the option to do that, yes.
So that I would propose that or make a motion to offer an interim consent agreement for a substance abuse evaluation by a board-approved physician. Dr. Bland's continuing his program that he's doing at the with his professional education for ethics. And then we also had I want to get this all in a CME, the evaluation, and as far as that we can, and the addition of the letter of concern.
Yes.
Any comments or discussions on that, gentlemen?
I will second that motion.
And, well, okay.
Wait, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, did you say that you were going to include a letter of concern?
Yes. That is.
As long as it's not for the same thing.
Okay, no, I'm sorry. That's correct. Then no letter, strike that.
Yes.
Well, just the evaluation for substance abuse potential by a board-approved physician in that area of expertise. Dr. Bland to continue his current process with his continuing education that he already has set up through the professional PDI. And then... So that would be my consent agreement, interim consent agreement.
And would you like to put a date certain on that?
Pardon me?
Would you like to put a date certain on the
for the beginning
for the evaluation? It's
hopefully within 30 days if possible for the evaluation. Dr. Blaine, how long does your program go for your CME?
I'm in the 6 month portion now.
How is it for 6 months or a year, or do they reevaluate?
It was 6 months from the time of completion.
So how much more do you have on that?
Quite a bit, yeah.
And if I may, President Campbell, right now are out a little further than 30 days. We're encountering that to get the person booked and then to have them seen and then for the doctor to turn around a report, the standard right now I'm seeing with DO and MD is 60. Thank you.
You gentlemen are in agreement. Sure. Mr. Rhodes, is that all fine by you for 60 days? Okay, that's good. So. In the motion to
point of information with yes. The interim agreement. So once, if the evaluation comes back that he's not a risk,
so we can revisit things. Yeah, or he's not a risk, but he's already processed to continue with his PDI, which I think is a good. You know that we would have that information, and we have the information.
Yes.
Correct. Okay, so we have all that all straight. Anybody else have any questions? Any other comments?
No, thank you.
Thank you to the members of the board.
Been moved and seconded. Mr. Rhodes, any more discussion?
We have to vote still.
We have to have a voice vote.
Yeah, you should, please.
Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Yolano? Dr. Campbell? Aye.
Mr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Unanimous. We pass. Thank you so much.
Your time.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
All righty. Now. We will move on then, sir. We're done with our investigation files. Next section is 6, which is review, discussion, possible action regarding reconsideration of a complaint and a board offered consent agreement for complaint number 19-32-E, Dr. Keith Bangart. Dr. Bangart is present with his counsel, William Souden. Souders, I'm so sorry. I couldn't read the writing.
I would move to go into executive session
for
legal advice.
It's been moved that we move into second. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? So moved. We'll return. Stay comfortable there. All right, so as we mentioned before, this glasses on here. We saw Dr. Bangart last month for case 1932-C, and as things were evaluated, our attorney general indicated to us that in this situation, because we found no violation of state statutes, a disciplinary action could not be ordered. So I will make a motion to rescind our previous consent agreement, disciplinary consent agreement for Dr. Banger.
Second.
Any discussion on that matter?
No.
Does this require a voice vote, too? Okay. So all in, Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Yolano?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. Mr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Thank you. So now, since we did not find any violation of state statutes, yet we still were concerned about the overuse of steroid injections in this case, because that's why Dr. Yolano had discussed doing a chart audit. So we definitely had some concern there. And there was also concern about surgical planning, the understanding of the biomechanics of the foot before and after surgery, and discussion regarding plantar plate injuries, that those were not properly addressed. I would make a motion then to offer Dr. Bangart a non-disciplinary order with a letter of concern regarding the overuse of steroid injections, and the second for the CME for 6 hours total, which is in addition to our 25 hours that we normally have for licensure. Those have to be board-approved courses. Like I said, 6 hours total in the topics of biomechanics and surgical planning, as well as the plantar plate injury pathogenesis and treatment. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you so much. Any discussion, gentlemen?
Nope.
No, are we?
Sure if for what it's worth, everything sounds just right. But Dr. Bangert's done some research in between last month and now on what courses are available. Mm-hmm. And so if we could maybe some out loud discussion about it right now prevents email back and forth on courses that are available to satisfy.
That's fine. Do you have something like,
good day.
Print the pamphlets or what they're offering? Are these online or are they?
No, so if you, so I looked on, the Podiatrist Institute, the state meeting next month. I mean, my question was there's one topic out of the whole weekend, at least in what I saw, and I know sometimes those change on. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know, and then, there was a 0.75 CME credit on Present, which is an online thing, and that's really all I've been able to find, just unless I'm searching wrong. So my question is, how does that work as far as, because there's not just CMEs just on second MPJ pathology that I've been able to find at this point. If you had any advice.
Yeah, Heather, does the CE, they said they were they had a compilation of courses.
That won't be implemented for at least another couple of months. Mm-hmm. They're still working on building the platform.
Have you?
So the one I saw in my, and again, I was just typing in planner plate. It was a 0.75. It was like a from Dr. Weil. It was a. That's all that was offered for present. But again, I haven't looked at present since residency, so.
Would literature be appropriate? Yeah, read.
Well, you know, sometimes you can find in journals where they have the CMEs in journals. Is that what you're talking
about?
Yeah. Well, we could, if he would present it to us, I mean, we can look at it.
Okay,
there's nothing wrong with that.
I think that's enough. And so what, not to slow things down, what I'll do is work with the doctor with this virus, and then we can, sounds like we're all aware that it might be a little bit tougher than just a cookie cutter program, but we'll get it.
So, like, I don't know if, ACFS or now the American Board of Podiatric, we've changed our name. The ACFOM is no longer ACFOM, but they may have some. I'm trying to think of who else would. Or maybe, maybe looking at some of the ortho cases, I mean, in MD arenas. I mean, there may be something there too.
Right.
I already found a couple on second. Former Arizona podiatrist, Dr. Bruce Werber, has written one. So, there definitely are on present. That's a residency one, so that's the one I was looking
for. Okay. And those are okay then, the online ones?
Yeah. 2018.
Okay.
You know, in some of the, I don't know if some of the residency programs around in town, like Dr. Geller at the county hospital, Dr. Dancho down in Tucson might have, I think there's a lot of CMEs down there that may have something.
I like I said, if you're okay with present, I can start searching present. I remember that from residency. It's been 10 years, but we had it then too. So
I think Dr. Dahuki has a program down there too. So. Okay.
And Dr. Kimball, board members, before you call the motion, and I'm just asking for clarification because I may have missed it when you were stating the motion, but is there a time frame in which you want him to?
Well, since we're having this discussion about this, it may take more than 30 days. So I think maybe if everybody's in agreement that, 60 days may be, it may take that long.
For CME.
Yeah. And then once we know what that is, because generally we give people, I don't know, 6 months or something.
Say it's 90 days.
90 days to complete things. So
90 days, and it is acceptable for him to complete all of them via electronic means?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That's reasonable. I mean, because we allow it, since this is above and beyond the normal 25, and we allow 10 on that, I have no problem. Do you gentlemen have any problem with that? I don't.
We're going to extend the motion
for
6 months then?
Well, we never gave it. I don't believe I gave a time frame in the original motion, did I?
So you would have to amend
that. We can make an amendment to that. So make an amendment to my original motion that we give up to 60 days for Dr. Bangart to find the... 90 days for him to complete. That's a better way to put it. Then that gives him, so if he finds things in 30 days, that's fine. And then the motion to give Dr. Bangart 90 days to complete the CME. I mean, if you run into a problem too, right?
Talk to Heather.
You guys, talk. Hopefully you won't run into that. So any second on that amendment?
Second.
Any more discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
So are we all set? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Steve Keller. No.
Alan just sent an email.
What happened? Holy crap.
I had it yesterday.
Oh, my God.
Let me get my hat together.
Yeah, let me just...
Motion for recess.
Craziness. Hello, Dr. Nazarian. We have you here. This is under headings 7, review discussion, possible modification, the clarifications regarding our motion to forward a complaint to a informal hearing. Your complaint number is 19-36-C. Do you have counsel, Dr. Nazarian, or no?
I haven't informed anybody.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know I was supposed to. I thought it was informal, so I thought it was just
right,
a Q&A type thing.
We had expected to see you at another meeting, and that's kind of where we had concerns that we wanted to be able to talk to you to get your part of this complaint, because it was presented to us, was January, correct, Heather? And Dr. Cohn was the investigator, and I believe Dr. Cohn, let's see here, he did not, did he? I'm looking, let me look here real quick. He did not find any violations, did he? Right, but because of the concerns and what had gone on here, we wanted to talk to you. So because there was, like I said, in expecting you and then we didn't see you, that's why we made a motion to move this to a formal hearing. So, and we don't have... Dr. Cohn's not on the phone that did the initial report, so...
Right. Madam Chair, board members, if I can interrupt for just 1 minute. So the informal interview was going to be... or informal hearing was going to be scheduled for the April meeting, but as I was drafting the notice of the informal hearing, I have to be able to cite violations. And because the board did not cite any violations and Dr. Cohn did not substantiate any of the allegations, the board... is unable to move it to a formal hearing until such a time that they cite violations. So that's the purpose of this meeting today. So it's not actually scheduled for an informal hearing.
Right.
So the board has to determine whether or not there are violations, and if there are, then at that time that they can forward it to an informal hearing. But sent Dr. Nazarian the notice, I did ask that he be present at today's meeting because I understood that the board did have concerns and wanted to speak with him. So he's here today to address any questions or concerns you may have, but Dr. Cohn was not asked to be available.
Right. Now, and remind me, Heather, when we did that initial with Dr. Cohn, did the complainant speak?
Yes, the complainant was present, and I did hear from the complainant that they were not going to be able to attend this meeting.
Seamus, is it appropriate if I kind of give a synopsis? You heard this, didn't you, Dr. Milano and Dr. Foreman? So do you feel like you want to rehash, to summarize things, or are you remembering enough of the case? I have questions that I'd like to ask. If we can proceed that way, is that okay? And then we can make, since Dr. Nazarian is obviously here. Okay. So actually, Dr. Nazarian, do you want to kind of give a synopsis or summary of your care of this, this patient?
I would. I would like to... Unfortunately, this morning at 4 o'clock when I got up to get ready to come down here, up north it was raining so hard, I went to my office and I grabbed the file to bring it down. I just went to open up the file to give you copies of it. I grabbed my corporate tax return that my accountant brought last night. It was sitting on the bottom of it, so I apologize. I have my tax returns instead. But I did make a statement. I had a, just to give you guys, and if you don't mind, I have it, and I'll read it off. If you don't mind, I'll be reading off the email. I just had my office scan it and email it to me. The only thing I don't have is all the information for. Do you guys have copy of all
we
the,
have everything in our file everything? On our computer.
Okay, perfect. So, because there's a lot of confusion, so I kind of figured I'll write down what has happened and then just sort of open it up for any question you may have. Ms. KF, that I had the opportunity to see her and examine her or initially on January 18th of 2017. She came in with in my office with a complaint of a painful first metatarsophalangeal joint that has been ongoing for years. She had been seeing physicians in Phoenix, and she has had multiple injections, excess of 8 cortisone injections in her joint. And she had been treated conservatively with shoe modifications as well. And after I saw her, I examined her. I explained to her the risks associated with excess cortisone injections on the bone capsule, tendon weakening, fat tissue, atrophy, and so on. I also further on explained to her and her husband that to do more injections will not be more of a permanent solution. It'll be temporary. Plus, I would refuse to do that. She can get somebody else to do it. I won't do it because she's had more than 3, which is my standard injection policy for 3. And I have been in educational research before, and one of the biggest things with the Mayo Clinic that they had seen was the excess use of cortisone and the damage that may give to the tissues. So based on that, I had explained it to them, the logic behind it. The patient and her husband were given thorough explanation regarding the options, as well as the surgical option of the arthroplasty with the use of arthrosurface implant. They were given the website information. And usually I have a brochure I hand out to them. It's been 3 years. I don't know if I gave them the handout or not, but they always have access to the website, which I show them to almost all my patients. And they get plenty of information before that. So a week after the appointment, they came back with her husband, and we sat there and we had a further discussion regarding the surgery, and they opted to proceed with it. Mind you, there are multiple surgical options, but since I'm very much experienced and I've been doing this since 2011, I'm very comfortable with this procedure, which is within the standard of care of the Alex Rigidus type of form that she's had. They were given plenty of time to go over the consent form. Usually takes about half an hour in my office to do the consent with the diagram, which shows what I do with it. And I also want to mention at this point, I also tell them during the surgery, if I find the cartilage is adequate and it's not damaged, I don't violate the cartilage. I'll change it to a hilectomy or shorting osteotomy, or I may do something different. But like in her case, I only end up doing the metatarsal head, because the base, if it has more than 50% cartilage, you don't need to do anything to it, and she had it, so I didn't pursue with that. She just had the metatarsal head fragment done. And at the same time, they're given my number, and they are also given all the appropriate post-op care, what it's going to take and what is going to be involved. And because this is a arthroplasty, range of motion is extremely important for this in order not to fuse, because for a procedure that we do for arthrosurface, it's significant soft tissue release. And to do all the soft tissue release, you got to maintain the range of motion like we do with the knees as they do the total knees and what have you. So I demonstrate that to them as well, that they're going to be have to be weight-bearing and they're going to have to motion the foot. A week later, so this is 2 weeks since the initial visit, she came in, we went through the procedure, she had the surgical procedure performed on February 1st. So initially I'd seen her on January 18th. 2 weeks later when I saw her, we went through the surgical protocol. As I was doing the process of the placing the hemicap, first of all, for the physicians, you guys are familiar with the arthro surface implant and what have you. That's important because she had been told that I used a large size post, which is false. There's only one post. There's no variation of sizes of placing a post. And that's one of the things she's been misled. So anyway, the post was put in, and the metatarsal shaft, you know, which is one size, it's been all debrided and fixed. The post was put in, the cap was put in, and at this point I had decided not to do the base. As I was examining the post, a little avulsion fracture type, size of, smaller than a pea size, on a dorsal medial side of the metatarsal came loose. At that point, I looked at that little piece of bone. I had an option of just removing it. I couldn't fixate because there's a post there, so I circulated wire. They said, it's already there, I'll just circulate it, let it stay in there. Which I put it back in there, I impacted it, and I circulated it. And the fixation was very stable at that point. There was no need to do anything further. I have in past used bone cements if the fragment, the hemicap, if it was loose. But hers was really solid and it was firm, so therefore I didn't have to do anything further. I stabilized it, I circulated, wired it, and closed everything, and she was doing fine, and I came out. And let me jump into the part. So afterwards, after the surgery was done, I went and I told the family, I told her husband of the finding, and I did tell her that due to either all her genetics, excess cortisone injection, the capsule was extremely thin. There was just hardly any soft tissue left from so much injection she has had. The head, the tarsal head was more than 70% denuded from cartilage. And she, when I put the implant in, a little bone did come off, and I circulated wired it, and I we're going to maintain this by splinting I've done, but she needs to have a range of motion. I don't want the joint to freeze. And I told her what the protocol is going to be. So at this point, I want to say she, on her charges, made an accusation that I told her husband that I don't know what to do for her as far as for broken foot. And apparently, I don't, again, this is 3 years ago, but I'm just basing it what she said, that her husband says he's not a doctor, he's an engineer, he doesn't know, he can't help me. That, beside that, it just doesn't even make sense. I would never ask a physician, or I mean a patient's family, to help me what to do with it, especially with the, beside my training, in Northern Arizona, I'm one of the on-call physicians in the ER that I do ton of fractures. Just this week alone, I've done 6. I mean, there's not a fracture that I haven't reduced, that I haven't worked with, because we're very limited as far as number of physicians available there. So what is she assuming, or the context they heard, I have no idea what it was. Again, this was 3 years ago, I don't recall, but I never would have asked her husband help me how to fix the broken bone, even though it was circularized and it was splinted. And then she came in, and she had a post-op x-rays done. She had intro x-rays and as well as post-op x-rays done. This is all done on C-arm. And my biggest concern with the x-rays were, because this was a little bit of an avulsion fracture and it was a non-weight-bearing surface, I want to make sure the metatarsal was not cracked. And the x-ray showed everything was fine. There was no kind of stress fracture on the metatarsal per se. And if you see that little fragment, the way it comes up, you really, it does look like an avulsion type of a fracture that could happen. So anyway, she comes in, and I see her, and I explain everything to her. Her first post-op, she was doing good. The second post-op, I saw the swelling and stuff. We got x-ray. She was healing the wound just fine. And then I explained to her that because of the swelling, because you had this, even though the type of swelling she was having, and I wanted her to have a range of motion and a passive range of motion. I had explained it to them, to the patient's husband, how to do that as well. The second visit, when I saw it, I said, this is probably from you've been on him too much. You've been walking on him a lot. And her husband agreed that she's constantly walking. She's nervous. So she always walks. She had walked excessively. I said, well, that's okay. In that case, I'm going to put you in a cam walker. So I put her in a cam walker. And the following week when she came in, which we took another x-ray, she had... the swelling was stable, the joint was stable, everything was going okay. She was having some pain with it, and I explained to her that because of her bone was being weak and because of the that little fragment, next time I will put a 4-foot cast on you. The 4-foot cast is a portable cast that you can take off and put on after you bait. Just kind of immobilize the little pieces of fragment that you have. And I did notice that on my notes, on my chart, that unfortunately when I'm off-site, I click these, I hate these generic templates. I have my own templates. I don't use generic stuff. When we went to click for planning for the 4-foot cast, it clicked casting for orthotics. They were never charged for casting. They were never charged for orthotics. And it's just the way it appears. And nevertheless... she came in again, and meanwhile, I took her 4 weeks later. This is within 4 weeks period, so there'll be her third post-op visit. I took another x-ray. So she's had a total of 3 x-rays in 4 visits, and everything always looked good. The fragment looked good. Everything was sitting stable. The bone was just healing. As you know, it takes 6 to 8 weeks before you see fragment healing. And pretty much after that, I never saw her. She never came back for a follow-up. She never returned. Now, the issues that she brought up that I'd like to discuss, one with the fact that I asked her husband, I have no idea what that she's referring to as far as helping me to fix a broken foot. Second thing about the concern of, I have it all written down. These are just too small for me to read off of this. The fact that she was not given any other option and she was kind of rushed into the surgery, she had seen me 3 times before the surgery. I had discussed all of that. She had been treated for this condition for years with multiple injections. She had all the opportunity to choose not to have it done. It wasn't like she walked in and the next day we scheduled the surgery and she was in a OR within a couple of days. This is literally within three weeks she had the surgery. And then as far as the post-op care, she was constantly being monitored on a regular schedule, as I always do with post-op care. She was just having some residual swelling and she was just being impatient with it. And I just, there's not much I can do with it. Then later on, I find out that she had an RSD of her arm. And if you look at her patient information she has filled out, for existing medical conditions you're being treated for, she has only checked off hypertension. That's all she has put down. She hasn't mentioned anything about RSD or anything that she had on her arm or anything. She's very nervous, and her husband always told me that she had... the only way she can calm herself down is by walking. So it was just excess use that was causing post-op swelling, which I could have managed it. And furthermore, as far as my notes are concerned, every time I open up my note for follow-up, the previous note appears and I make modification. And when there's a surgery, I always have the full note there for the biller to know exactly what we've done, because the billers are off-site, they come in online, and they look, make sure what I've told them, what the procedure is, what the code and what my notes are, they match. They're not relevant to that. So even though you see a lot of notes there, but technically if you look at the billing part of it, you'll see the portion of the billing. There's no charges for them. That's mostly for housekeeping purposes. I have to have those in there. And at the end of the day, I treated them with extreme respect, love, and care, and I gave them my professional opinion. I told them I've been doing this for, I just found out yesterday, July 7th of 2011 was my first Arthro Surface I put in. I give lectures on this material. I've done labs. I've taken a couple of labs myself. I've taught multiple labs as well. And I'm very comfortable with it. And I know exactly what needs to be done, how to manage the post-op complications. We even have multiple modalities to address if things fail. So with that said, I don't know what else. Now I'm open for your questions. Thank you.
Dr. Nazarian, one of the questions that Dr. Cohn had asked you too was, I had some concern about you injecting
well, the cortisol
in the surgery yeah. time. And he
so
said,
that's not in the joint. I mix them with my Marcaine. I'm glad you brought that up. I mix that with my Marcaine and I inject them. It's usually for that, I inject them by cuneiform area. It's nowhere near a surgical site, and that's just mostly with 20 cc's of Marcaine that I mix them with, just basically for inflammatory purposes. But it's not into the joint or in the capsule directly, like they have been in the past.
You addressed my question about the RSD, because that was one I had.
You know, I just learned that recently from you guys about that. She never brought it up to me. She never mentioned it to me. I'm hoping you guys have her initial office form to fill out. She just says checked off hypertension.
Yeah, you can't control, you know, they don't tell you stuff, I mean. It happens all the time.
And as far as managing post-op, it was not a weight-bearing fracture that you had to immobilize the patient, per se. And it was an avulsion fracture, and a cam walker is more than adequate to stabilize that.
And she didn't have any other trauma after the surgery was done?
No.
And you casted her for orthotics when she was she
no,
still swollen?
No, I did not cast her.
You did not.
No, I did not cast her for orthotics. That's the problem is when I'm on my Prescott office, I log on to my Cutler office. That's where my EMRs are. And as the mouse, I move to click, the 4-foot cast is right above right below the orthotic casting. And when you click it, I've noticed this, that it happens occasionally. It just as you're clicking, you're clicking the box, but it catches the other one. That's what technology that happens. But the key to it is, if you look at the charges, I didn't charge her for casting. There was never a charge for casting, per se. And even for the cam walker, I never charged them that day, because a lot of times I may have to take the cam walker back and put a cast on, and if they're on it for a week, then I charge them a week later, because it's much easier to charge them later than to retract your charges.
I couldn't imagine why you would take a cast when the foot's still, because you would not have a good cast, and therefore you wouldn't have a good orthotic.
That was an error. That was an error, and I didn't cast before, and I looked at it. The box is right below that box. When I clicked for 4-foot cast, it clicked the orthotic cast, and that it's there. But she was never casted or charged.
Okay. Dr. Foreman, Dr. Yolanda, any questions?
No. She had multiple steroid injections, but that was prior to your taking over the case. That was from Dr. Discount, correct?
Correct. She's had a total of eight injections.
80?
Eight.
Eight. Okay.
That's an excessive injection.
Yeah. Well, I don't see any violations of state statutes, gentlemen.
I don't see any.
So now, do we have to do we rescind? Do we have to, so we, in order to do that, we have to rescind our previous motion to move this to Please. An informal interview.
Second it.
Any discussion? Close board.
Please.
Dr. Aye. Foreman, Dr. Ioano.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell, aye. Mr. Rowe.
Aye.
So moved. Okay, now, so after our discussion and meeting here with Dr. Nazarian today and hearing that I would
make a motion to dismiss the charges with no violation of state statutes.
Thank you very much. A second, please.
Second.
Any discussion on that? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So moved. Thank you, Dr. Nazarian. Should we do your portion here before we do others? Are you okay on the schedule?
It's up to you guys. I'm here for you, so.
All right,
you guys
we'll
move through the other parts of the schedule. We'll, it's up
let's,
to you.
Yeah, let's go on. Move back to number four to our meeting minutes. We have the general session meeting minutes of 2/12/20. I did find something. I just wanted to Heather on. The case 19-43-C, which was Dr. Crohn's, and the discussion, it's on page 7 of our packet, that the ABN form, it should have been for the surgical shoe as well as the shower boot, because those are both non-covered. That's the only, that was the only correction I had.
Repeat that one more time, I'm sorry.
The surgical shoe.
Surgical shoe, okay.
Have anything? So I will move to accept our general session minutes from 12/12/20 with the correction or additions made.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right, and we have our executive session minutes from 2/12/20. I didn't find any issues with the notes of the minutes.
Make a motion to approve the executive session minutes.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Then we can move on then to our issuances of licenses. We have three applications. Our first is Ms. Dr. Matthew Klein. Everything's in order. He's paid his fee. He's passed the time for finishing a surgical residency in 17. He has a license from Texas. The application and issue a license to Dr. Matthew Klein.
Seconded.
And does he have any other fee to pay, Heather, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so upon and with payment of fee.
3 seconds.
Thank you. Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. All right, our next is Candace Cooper. She is still in her training and residency and will be completed on June 30th. She has paid the $450, so I will move to approve her application for licensure and issue a license upon delivery or presentation the document indicating the successful completion of her residency and payment of her license fee.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. And it's a Maria Ibanez. She has paid everything in full. I have a question because she had all those other. Could she have applied by comedy, Heather?
I was trying
to add that up.
I don't believe that she met the time frame.
Okay, because I was looking, counting. I thought I'll just double check. So, all right. Anyway, so I will make a motion to approve. Dr. Ibanez's application and issue a license to for practice. We have a second. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. And then we move on to C for applications for registration to dispense drugs and devices. Our first is Kat Leah Gorman. Everything is complete. Payment and DEA, everything's in there. So I will make a motion to approve the application for Dr. Gorman for the initial registration to dispense drugs and devices. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? So moved. Now, the next one, Dr. Polson, I had found in his application that he only had listed drugs on his dispensing, what he was going to dispense. So I brought that to Heather's attention. She emailed him, and he sent her, you know, all the DME. So that will be added. I just didn't want to have things come back. So seeing that we have that, he has paid his $200. So I will make a motion to approve the application, initial application for registration to dispense drugs and devices for Dr. Polson.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Compliance updates. Dr. Farrell.
Yes. As of today, I've not had any further correspondence from Dr. Farrell. The last I heard was that he's still just trying to obtain an attorney. So after speaking with the Assistant Attorney General Seamus, we are going to let him know that he's had adequate time to obtain representation and that we're going to move these matters to the April board meeting. I still have not gotten the report back from the nerve decompression that he did in, I believe it was either December or January. I have not gotten that report back from Dr. Holokop, but as soon as I get that back, that matter will be continue to the next available meeting. So unless you have any questions on Dr. Farrell, I have an update on Dr. Heyman as well.
Heather, remind me. So on Patrick Farrell, if he didn't send any of the information on that last surgery?
He did. I sent it.
So he's okay. We didn't.
Yes. I've sent everything to Dr. Polokop. I just haven't gotten Dr. Polokop's report back yet. But the other matter, I believe, is 1808C that Dr. Cohn is working on. That can be forwarded to the April meeting. And if by chance he does retain an attorney, just so the board is aware, the attorney is probably going to ask for a continuance, because they're going to need to become familiar with the case. So in that event, we would grant that request. Dr. Heyman, the last update I got from him was just an email saying that he's not performed any osteotomies, and that's included for your review.
What date did he send you that, Heather?
That was a few weeks ago. I don't remember the exact date.
So it was within what he supposed to, his time?
Yeah, it was February 18th.
Okay, next here would be the discussion under E, renewal applications. So Heather.
Yes. I put this on the agenda to talk to the board about authorizing its executive director to approve any applications that do not have any background information included. So, for example, all of the questions are answered appropriately. You know, they don't have a malpractice matter, no arrests, anything like that. I can just approve them, and I do not have to put them on a consent agenda for the board to look at. The board does have the authority to do that under ARS 32-3123. If the board would authorize the executive director to do that, then I would also ask that we require all licensees to submit continuing education documentation, whether it's certificate of completion. As of right now, they only have to list their continuing education. They don't actually have to send documentation unless I have a question. If I have a question, I'll ask for it. So that's one part of it. The other part is at a prior meeting, there was a case that came before the board And there was a question as to whether or not he had answered a question on the renewal application appropriately, and it was regarding the malpractice matter. And I received an NPDB report, but after I obtained additional information, it was an informal claim. It wasn't an actual malpractice matter. So the question came up as to whether or not we should have two separate questions on the renewal application. So I did research some other jurisdictions and their questions that they ask on their renewal applications. So I included a copy of the renewal application and highlighted those sections that I made the changes to. So it's just asked whether or not the board wants to add that language. And there's two questions. Let me get to the page. I can tell you.
On the licensing, there is a section there for downloading certificates.
Yes, there is.
It's already on there.
So it's page number 3,189 of your materials. And it's question 5, B1 and B2 is how I labeled them. Those are the two questions that I added that I thought would be in alignment with what the board was looking for. And they're both pretty similar, so both questions don't need to be added, but I just wanted to give the board some options.
What page did you say that one?
3,189.
Oh, geez, Barb. Put the one in there. Like, that's a transcript. Wait a minute. Duh. Like, it's more inclusive, it covers both things. Do you have an opinion, Seamus? B2, because I think that's where we were having the issue primarily, was there was a settlement, mm-hmm. and we didn't know.
It was an informal claim.
Right.
And there was a payout,
maybe that,
I believe.
Do you think that maybe that addresses it better than the other one?
Yeah, because actually the doctor didn't even know about it.
Right, yeah, exactly.
If I can add the VISE B2 question.
What do you gentlemen think?
I concur.
Do we need a motion?
Yeah, that should be in a motion, okay, to delegate authority to her.
I will make a motion to delegate our executive director, Heather Brodus, to make the addition in our application for licensure under question 5, professional conduct, adding subsection B2.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Thanks, Heather. I think that will make, hopefully, clear up some problems.
Madam Chair, members of the board, could we also have a motion to delegate renewal authority to her as well?
Thank you. Because that was kind of the main gist here, wasn't it? Okay, so I will make a motion to give privilege to our executive director, Heather Brodus, to review applications for licensure. No, just as on our renewals, correct?
Just renewals.
Yeah, on renewals to approve our applications. Without bringing them to the board for review. Unless there is an issue, obviously.
Okay, perfect.
Seconded.
Okay. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right. Seamus, you are up under 8 here. Discussion possible action regarding presentation by our Assistant Attorney General regarding our board options for taking action adjudicating cases.
You guys got the memo. So I think what I'm going to do.
Sorry about that. What I'm going to do first is just walk you through the memo, and then if you have any questions, I think that'd be the best way to do it, because after we talk about it, I think things will start to come to fruition in your mind, and you'll know what questions to ask me. And just to, for reference, this is a general education since it's on the open record. So ARS 32852.01 is what gives the board authority to take non-disciplinary and disciplinary action. The outlier in 852.01 is your emergency action authority. And your emergency action authority comes into play whenever you have a situation where you believe that there's imminent danger to public health or safety if you don't take action. And usually that can be accomplished by stating on the record that the board believes that there is an imminent danger to public health and safety, and so summary suspension is the only appropriate action in the interim. Subsection B of 852.01 is all your non-disciplinary options. And so that's basically going to be your initial review. And at your initial review, your three options are pretty limited. You can either dismiss, file a letter of concern, or issue a non-disciplinary order requiring the licensee to complete a prescribed number of CMEs. Today you saw that one of the issues that comes into play when you're trying to file a letter of concern and issue a non-disciplinary order for CEs is that you don't want those orders to be redundant. So if you have an issue with chart auditing, but you also have an issue with surgical practices, then you would bifurcate the two, and your letter of concern would address one, and then your CMEs would address another. And from our office's standpoint, another part of that is that the only time that you're going to issue that non-disciplinary CE is when you believe that retraining, when it rises to the level of retraining. If you don't think that they need to be retrained, maybe you just think that they weren't doing their job correctly, being lazy, not paying attention, then you would issue a letter of concern in that instance. Any questions so far?
So you can consider the non-disciplinary CME to be, what's the term I want to hear? Just kind of not re... It's not a rehabilitation of a practitioner. That's more of a discipline, correct?
Yeah, no, it's a retraining.
Redirection.
So after the board has completed its investigation, that's the time when the board votes to consider whether they want to move to informal hearing if they don't choose one of the non-disciplinary actions. And that's when you believe that, you know, disciplinary action is probably warranted. You're going to want to push it to that next stage.
And again, when the reminder that it's minimum, what did you say before, when we minimum level, we're not adjudicating, we can't.
We don't regulate best practices. We regulate minimum practices, which I've gotten really good at saying. So, but if you do believe that the allegations in the complaint and the evidence that you've looked at are true, but not of sufficient seriousness to suspend or revoke the license, then you can. You do have disciplinary options available to you, but that's because you have already cited a potential violation and moved it to an informal hearing. And at that stage, you can then step back and say, well, maybe we don't need disciplinary action. We've seen it. We've talked to them. Maybe we now believe that it's back down to filing a letter of concern or issuing that non-disciplinary continuing education, because you still can use all your non-disciplinary options, even at a disciplinary level. You can also fix a period of terms of probation. And, you know, I noted it here in the memo, but the important thing to recognize is that where in 852.01c, they give you your three, specifically enumerate your three non-disciplinary options. In D, they choose to generally define fixing a period in terms of probation because they couldn't have possibly put every single term of probation in here. So, and that's where chart auditing comes in, and that's why that's a disciplinary action.
So are you saying, too, that anytime we do a chart audit, it needs to be attached to terms of probation? Or can you just
It is a term of probation.
Because I think in the past we may have had chart audits, but they were after a time of probation, and we did a voluntary audit. So, okay, if we did that on one doctor. After they had completed their probationary time, and then isn't that what we did with Dr. Clark, right? That then we had that extended period of audit that was voluntary. Am I correct, Heather?
He agreed to that, though. Yeah. The licensee agreed to undergo a voluntary audit because the board still had concerns.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue that you run into is where you know, you're assigning what you essentially wouldn't think would be disciplinary action at a non-disciplinary, like the chart auditing. It's easy to consider that not a disciplinary act, even though it is considered a term of probation under the statutes. You also, I forgot to mention, you also have the ability to offer interim consent agreements. And those interim consent agreements can be disciplinary if the board finds potential violations at that stage, and there is a risk to the public. It doesn't necessarily have to be imminent danger, but there's a public health or safety issue. You can go down the road of offering an interim consent agreement. You know, I think that's about all I have, if you guys have any questions.
Do we have this printed out for us?
I can print it out.
Just send it. Is it okay? Put it in an email attachment?
Yeah.
Can we have that on our personal computers to print out, or how do we?
And it might be easier if I put together like a chart for the board at its different levels, and what kind of action can be taken at each level. Maybe that would be more helpful.
Yeah, that way everybody has one for a good
one. And it would be a one-pager instead of James's five-page.
I pared this down from a 14-page. Okay.
So I can put something together and run it by you and Seamus, and then just keep it in your red travel folders.
Just we keep it with us to have a reminder.
And again, I think the most important thing for you guys in doing your job to remember is just that at the initial stage, you have all your non-disciplinary options. Once you get past that initial stage, you have all your disciplinary and non-disciplinary options. And once you're past that initial stage, you can also start. That's at a point where you are able to order. You don't have to enter into consent agreements. You can require licensees to take certain actions, as long as it is represented in the record. And so that's something that becomes very important, is especially in a summary suspension situation, you're going to want to make sure the record is very clear that you had concerns about A, B, C, and D, and that A, B, C, and D equal imminent danger to public health or safety. And even the same with consent agreements. You know, sometimes you may have a wild consent agreement, a very different consent agreement. As long as you put on the record the reasons why this is the consent agreement that you want to offer, then you're good. That'll cure any issues that may arise later.
Thank you, Shannon. Now, does that go for education for the new board members because you have to have so many hours?
Maybe. Yeah, I can also, I do have a document that I found. It's about 30 pages, but it's very helpful. It's kind of like this, what we were just looking at. It's kind of like my memo, but it has a lot of bullet points, and, you know, I can tailor it to your guys' board, and I can also send that to Heather. She can give that to you.
Yeah, thank you. That sounds good.
It also has other tips for, you know, where your headspace should be at certain parts of the proceedings, things that you should be thinking about. And so I'd be happy to provide that.
Heather Nine, Executive Director's Report.
Yes, thank you. So to start with the report, I have the rulemaking on there. And I just want to remind board members that whenever I started with this board last April, the previous executive director, Christina Gomez, was in the middle of the rulemaking progress. And that had to do with getting rid of the state exam and the rules. So whenever I started, the board, you know, decided to move forward with making other rules. And that was allowing licensees to complete all of their continuing education via electronic means, increase the renewal fee, prorate the license issuance fee, and then whenever legislation passed to require the temporary application, implement a $100 fee for that. So the request to raise the renewal fees was denied by the governor's office. So that one is completely off the table. I've gotten approval to allow licensees to obtain all of their continuing education via electronic means. And then just recently on February 27th, I got approval from the governor's office to implement the $100 fee for a temporary license. The one issue that I still have not heard back on, and I'm afraid that this just kind of got pushed, you know, under some piles of paper somewhere, is the proration of the initial license fee. And so I just kind of wanted to give the board an update on the entire process, how long it's taken. So what I want to ask the board is if the board wants me to follow up with the governor's office regarding the proration of the initial license fee, or if it just wants me to move forward with what I have the approval on to go with now. And if that is the case, the board can always look at prorating the initial license fee at another time if it decides to go through the rulemaking process again. If I follow up with the governor's office regarding the proration of the initial license fee, then I would expect it's going to take at least another 3 to 4 months. So it's really up to the board. I'm willing to do whatever the board wants me to do. I just wanted to bring it to your attention because of the time frame issue.
What is it right now? No proration?
Right. So currently, I don't believe you were a board member yet whenever I reviewed this. you know, all licensees are required to renew by June 30th of each year. So depending on when a person becomes licensed, they either get a 6-month license or an 18-month license. And basically, the cutoff is December 30th, and I don't know the history behind it, but apparently this is how the board has been interpreting it since at least 10 years, is from what I understand. So if somebody, for example, let's say somebody got licensed in December of 2019, and they paid their prorated or their license fee at that time, then I'm going to give them an expiration date of August 31st of 2020. So essentially they're getting a six-month license. If somebody were to wait until January 1st of 2020 to pay that license fee, I'm going to give them an expiration date of August 31st, 2021. So they're getting an 18-month license. So that's when I asked the board whether or not they wanted to prorate the license fee, and it would be on a monthly, you know, basis, just to make it more fair for licensees or new applicants, I should say, on what's being paid.
And you would think the governor's office would like that proration because of keeping costs down and trying not to prohibit people from licensing.
Right. And whenever I got the okay on February 27th to implement the $100 for the temporary license, I chose not to ask about that. And, you know, I did staff it with Dr. Campbell just because I wanted it to be more of a board decision because of the time frame. And this process has been going on for over a year now.
What do you think?
I think it's a wash. Some people, I hear, it's all going to come out equal in the end, so... Mm-hmm.
For the board's fund, yeah.
I can't remember if we've had anybody complain.
I've not had.
It's never been an issue. I don't remember any. You know, we prorate CMEs for them. Mm-hmm. That's already in statute, obviously.
That's outlined.
Yeah. Okay.
So just
kind of leave it alone?
Yeah.
And move forward with the two exemptions? Okay.
What do you think?
Bureaucracy make opportunity for all a lot easier.
And then with this legislation just pertains to the podiatry bill specifically, and I know I sent an email out regarding reasons why SB 1087 was stalled. So a striker bill was found, SB 1094. It's gone through the first and second read in the House, so there's an update since I last sent out this memo. On Monday, this past Monday, both Dr. Campbell, Mr. Boddy, and myself all met with Representative Bartow and her staff to talk about any concerns, questions they had about SB 1094 and potential amendments. There is a House hearing tomorrow for SB 1094, so myself, Dr. Campbell, and Mr. Boddy all plan to attend. And I did receive an email from House staff with potential amendments. So currently SB 1094 includes the fingerprinting, the clarification of the definition of podiatry to include the performing full body physical exams, and elevating practicing without a license to a class 5 felony, and that's consistent with state statute. So the proposed amendments, and last time I checked, they're not posted on the legislator's website yet. They should be sometime this afternoon, though. From what I understand, the proposed amendments are going to be clarification of the residency, adding in the record retention schedule to be consistent with state statute. There's two more, and I'm drawing a blank. Kimball. Let me look. I have them here.
Having two separate bills, you know, it's kind of
confusing. Here we go. Combining the applications, so the initial application and the dispensing application, and then authorizing the board to create fees and rules for public records, duplicate wallet cards, audio files.
Oh, and the fees.
Which one's the fees in?
Yep, that's it. That's authorizing the board to create fees and rules. Uh-huh. So the section that has not been added back in and will not be added back in is the unprofessional conduct, the ethical, those three sentences that were added in that we took from the national guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was
a big fight.
And it's something that the board wasn't aware of. The board didn't know that that was going to be a political argument. So hopefully if all goes well, the amendments will be put back in. The bill will be almost identical to what it was, excluding those three sentences. And I'm going to change the order a little bit. So complaint number 19, and well, I'm sorry, I should ask, does anybody have any questions about SB 1094? Complaint number 1930B, Dr. De La Cruz at its previous meeting, I think it was January, it's January meeting, the board issued a offered a consent agreement in order. Dr. De La Cruz was given a time frame to sign that order. I got correspondence from his attorney that they're unwilling to sign it and they want it to move to a formal hearing. Or an informal hearing. So that's going to be scheduled for the April meeting. So the board will see that again. And then board investigators, Dr. Steck is now officially a board investigator. He's been assigned two investigations. I'm just waiting on reports back from him. I've had some other licensees contact me, and I provided the names of those licensees. The only one I've heard back from is Daniel Saunders, and I do have an item on the April agenda for his correspondence to be reviewed by the board as a potential investigator. Any questions on those two? The next item is the medical assistance, and I know the board has discussed this a lot in the past, but as Dr. Campbell and I have been meeting with Mr. Abadi quite a bit recently, we've discussed this more, so I've researched it further. I looked at the medical board, the osteopathic board, and they do have language in their rules and statutes regarding medical assistance, but they do not license or certify those. So there's no regulation over the medical assistance by either of those boards. The only approval process that they have is their education if they do not go to an accredited program. If it's not an accredited program, then the board will determine whether or not it will meet what an accredited program would offer. So that's the only approval process that either of those boards take. So the board does have the option of going through, you know, legislation and the rulemaking process to include this kind of language. But what I want to point out is it still will not resolve the issue of the exam for podiatric medical assistance. What this will do, and please, Sheena, stop me if I am not spot on, but it will give guidelines for medical assistants that work in a podiatric facility, basically for the licensee. You know, the licensee has to follow these guidelines. They have to make sure that their medical assistants have this training, can only do these things, that kind of a thing, because it's going to fall on the licensee at that point if there's a complaint or grievance against the medical assistant. And it's going to require that a medical assistant go through that accredited program. It still doesn't solve the issue of the X-ray certification process, because that's not something that this board regulates. It's regulated by the Department of Health Services. And even if we added in this language, it's not going to require that the Department of Health Services create an exam just for a podiatric medical assistant.
Had an exam.
Did.
25 years. That's the problem.
I know.
And I mean, for podiatric medical assistants to have to approve a test for chest x-rays and sinus x-rays is way above and beyond the statutes that they needed for foot x-rays. So that's, I understand.
Yeah.
You're stuck. I mean, that's something that needs to be addressed. Test because they wouldn't even answer us.
No, I know, right? And I think that you're up to speed on this. It's not a board issue. It's not something that the board can address. Right.
Jurisdiction.
Yeah, I mean, we did write a letter to DHS. They chose not to respond. Yeah. I don't know if you have any.
And the state association, didn't they?
We're at an impasse.
Yeah.
Nothing we can do.
When they want information from us, I'll just ignore them. If the board wants to consider potentially adding in this language, just let me know and I can put it on a future agenda. If that's the case, I would ask too that the association, state association, be present.
Put that on, and then we can, you know, everybody has time to look at stuff from the DOs and MD boards, and we can create our.
It's not going to do anything for the current situation.
No, but I mean, but as far as if you want to have the medical, you know, have that language put in. About medical assistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just ask if board members, if any board member wants this on a future agenda, just let me know and I'll make sure it gets on one.
Because we have people call all the time and want to know what a medical assistant can do, and all we have is a substantive policy statement.
Right. Okay.
I'm just thinking, you know, maybe this is more defined and might be, you know,
and you don't have to include all of the language that the DO board and the medical board use.
You know, with us, yeah.
I think it's important to define.
Yeah, so that's why, you know, at some point in time when we're, you know, ready, you know, and invite Dr. Peters and whoever else from the state, you know, they have more than welcome, and then that way there can be, you know,
but
they know what's going on.
Right. Any questions? That's all I
bother in, too. And that was part of the thing that the DO and the MD stuff showed, that if somebody was, you know, before a certain time that, you know, they were grandfathered and there was nothing to do.
And then I have the current budget. I can answer any questions there. And then I have a current complaint log in your travel folders for you, too. And that's all I have for the executive director's update. I just said that the most current budget is included, and the most current complaint log is in your red travel folders.
So then we just have the legislative update, right?
And I can go through each and every one of these if you want me to, or I could just kind of go through the ones that are really going to affect this board.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay. let me scroll through. And a lot of these bills, like the Senate Bill 1212, the bill is awaiting a third read, so that bill is not going to continue to move forward. So, and that had to do with universal recognition, so I'm just going to kind of skip through those.
Which one? You said 1212?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it says that clinical, I don't know if that's a typo, clinical supervision does not have to meet Arizona standards?
But like I said, the bill is it appears to be stalled. It's not it's not going to continue to move, so it won't go anywhere. So that's why
everybody just come on it.
Those I'm just going to kind of skip over. This one doesn't pertain to podiatry specifically, but SB 1274 relating to professional occupational regulatory boards, it changes the composition of board members for certain agencies. So that's just something to keep in mind, that this could happen to this board at some point.
Barber and an accountant.
Yes. Mm-hmm. 2408, and I touched on this one at the last meeting. This allows a podiatrist and certain other medical doctors as well to receive continuing education, 1 credit hour for each hour of free medical services that are provided, and it goes through who an eligible patient is. And this bill is moving forward, and it's already been through a second read in the Senate.
That'd be like down at some of the clinics that are around in town, if the doctor's going into one of those clinics, or if it's access patients.
Yeah, an eligible patient is a person who does not have health insurance and whose annual household income does not exceed 200% of the federal poverty level, and a person eligible under access. And it has to be free services that they're providing. So it looks like the bill is going to move forward.
Asking their income.
So you can give free care, have the liability, but you get a CMU.
Oh, that's a plus.
Well, and if a licensee does fall under this and they use it as part of their continuing education, we'll just have to determine what kind of documentation we want to see. So, and there's one, it's House Bill 2536, and it's relating to telemedicine. And I believe podiatry was added in as an amendment to this bill, because I didn't have it on my last report. I'm not familiar enough with this to know if telemedicine is...
Is that the one that Heather Carter... No, she's Senate. Because I've seen some of that. I get things from her office, and there's been a lot, the telemedicine for, the people that are more in remote areas, that patients can be, a group of people can have, like, an office visit, or they use, but I think they've added, like, podiatry, considering things like wound care, mm-hmm. particularly, like I said, for people that are in more remote areas.
And basically just gives a definition for telemedicine, and healthcare provider does include a podiatrist, and it looks like this is going to continue to go through. It passed the House, and it's been transmitted to the Senate.
Telemedicine she can bill?
Hmm?
What's that for? You bill? You can do the telemedicine to
bill? Yeah, it just includes podiatry, so yeah, you could bill
more. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't directly affect podiatry either, but it's one that everybody's monitoring. House Bill 2740 relating to it consolidates the Barber Board and the Cosmetology Board. And it's going to move. It's going to pass. At least we're speculating. House Bill 2809 This requires an agency to reduce or waive fees if the agency's fund will exceed 50% of the appropriation for the current fiscal year. And this bill looks like it's going to pass as well. My analysis of the budget and talking with CSB, this board will not be affected, but most boards are going to be.
Because we're so small.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what is left over in our fund at the end of each fiscal year has to be at least 50% or exceed 50% in order for this to apply. And that doesn't apply in the podiatry board's case. But most boards are going to have to reduce or waive fees.
So, and we're, every board here is pretty, they're all 90-10s, right?
So that is my summary, unless you have any questions.
So, any summary of current events, please?
I do not have any.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I thought you heard me.
Oh, no. Sorry. And we have no call to the public, and the public is not there. Discussion and possible action for items for future meetings. We've discussed that as thinking about things with the medical assistance. So when we ever want to put that on, we can do that. Any, if there's anything else, just bring to Heather's attention. And our next meeting date is Wednesday, April the 8th, 2020. And at 12:33, I move to adjourn the meeting.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So thank you guys for a good meeting. I think we're very efficient. Thank you, Heather.
Mm-hmm.
Heather works very, very hard, you guys, and she is very efficient and Johnny on the spot.
Yes, I can see it. And thank you, Heather.
Sometimes we talk to each other like half the day. No.
My gosh. I've got to go through Tucson. I'll go through Tucson. Oh, no. She's got that thing on her foot. That's my sister-in-law.
Oh.
Tina. You know, I would make a motion because this thing ran over so late. That Heather take us to Duran's for lunch over there.
Is it in the budget?
I think the budget ought to pay for it.
We're over the 50% threshold, so we got to do it.
And, well, what I keep asking for is, where is my
swimming
pool?
That's right.
Where is my workout?
We got a charge next year, so
we
have a big party.
So you said Steve had a
blood disorder, a long-term blood disorder. That's what the obituary is. Yeah.
Wow. Because I just got a text from Charsky going, I just heard this. What's going on? He's younger than me. Well, God, what? After Gina was.
Wow. That's, oh my God.
I used to do Charsky really well.
Pardon me?
I used to do Charsky really well.
Oh. He was in the same way. And Barbara on Tennessee, so it's just like, her husband? I said, no. She goes, he follows you around like a little dog. I said, no.
It's John.
Disability. They're not going to be down skiing.
Oh, big slope. John, not small. Yeah.
I guess we're not going to Durant.
Yep.
Sorry, I'm breaking rules here.
All right. You know, I think we've all been pretty safe. States, there's one person in the state that's cured and one other person that's in, quarantine here in the whole state, so...